Chicago author Eitan McKaylee, Collaborations Anthony Mosley, and Drinking and Writing's Steve Mosqueda and Sean Benjamin. And now, here's your host, a man who wants to make America great again, Justin Kaufman.
I mean, it was great in the 80s and the 90s, but not so great in 2000. But great again, 2000. It just be great. Again. All right. Welcome to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Tonight, we got a great Chicago show. I'm so excited about tonight, featuring history, politics, theater, drinking, and of course, a little comedy. Mike Fouché is going to join us a little bit later to talk about the proposal by state GOP leaders to regain control of Chicago public schools. Is there merit to this, as the Trib editorial board just wrote about? Or is this just kicking a mayor when he's down? Because that's really what it feels like. Huh, is it blood in the water? Get him! Like, that's how it feels. But it's also known as good politics. So we'll talk with Mike about what's happening in Springfield. Also, we'll talk about the amazing history behind Chicago's newspaper, The Defender. Eitan McKaylee has written an amazing book called The Defender, How the Legendary Newspaper Changed America. Great story about how much of our history was influenced by the Southside newspaper. So we'll talk with Eitan about his book. Later in the show, we're going to talk with Anthony Mosley from Collaboration. They're putting on their final sketchbook fest this week. 15 years. This is the final week. We'll talk about the festival and get a live performance as well. And you may have seen the story about the two guys who took on the task of drinking their way down Western Avenue. It was like a viral hit last week, right? And people kept sending it around. And they're like, hey, did you see this? I had two or three people say, did you see this? And I opened it up and I'm like, I know those guys. Steve Mosqueda and Sean Benjamin, of course, from Drinking and Writing, which is a podcast, which is a theater show. Drinking and Writing Theater is right behind the Haymarket in West Loop. They're going to come on and talk about why they did this feat in the first place. Drank their way down Western Avenue, spent a whole weekend just drinking bar. One drink at every bar on Western Avenue. I guess Sean threw up, but we'll talk to him. Let him talk about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And, of course, tonight we debut a new segment. That's right. We're debuting a new segment called Character Flaws. It's going to be a weekly showcase for characters, sketch comedy, improv, and other performances. Tonight, we're going to introduce you to a protest organizer, a Wrigleyville ambassador, a 10 o'clock news anchor, and maybe get some light rock call-in in. It's always good to get some light rock call-in. Love notes. It's my favorite. But that's all lined up for the debut hour tonight. It's called Character Flaws. We're going to do it Wednesday nights at 10 o'clock. I think it's great. It's such a great city for it. Second City IO and all the different people that come here. You know, we have all these interviews, Pete, about all the great comedians that say, I got my start in Chicago. So let's hear from, let's get them to perform here in Chicago while they're here. So sit back and enjoy news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. And, of course, production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download. All right, let's kick things off with a carryout. This, of course, is the nightly segment where I read the newspaper so you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Republican leaders in Springfield are pushing for a state takeover of Chicago public schools. You know, the state, which doesn't have a budget and is billions in debt. The same state wants to run Chicago schools because Chicago is doing such a poor job. Now, I could understand if it was Indiana or maybe Oregon wanting to save our kids, but the state of Illinois, that's like sending your kids to live with grandma who lives in your basement. I mean, what would the state be able to do that the city can't? Well, for one, and only, it'd allow the schools to go into bankruptcy and try to break the teachers' union. Be clear, this is what big businesses do when they realize they don't want to pay their bills. There you go, Illinois, learning lessons from United Airlines. So, kids, no more lunches and less legroom. At the end of Sarah Palin's speech endorsing Donald Trump yesterday, she took a shot at President Obama, saying that when he comes back to Chicago, he'll look up and he'll see that shiny, brilliant Trump Tower. She went on to say, he built that, and that says a lot. No, it actually says Trump. And, right, that's what we think here. Man, look at that skyscraper. Trump built that? He's so great. He built a skyscraper? I should vote for him because his building's just so big. I mean, I'll bet that's not all that's so big. His ties are way too big.
I mean, you can't be president if your ties go to your knees, right? And every time I see Palin make a speech, I wonder if she's just ripping off the guy with the megaphone down on State Street. Has anyone checked to see if there's any plagiarism? We need to make America better. Right-wing and bitter, clinging, proud clingers of our guns. Wait, is that the Sarah Palin speech or the new Toby Keith song? I can never tell. In world news, ISIS has leveled the oldest Christian monastery in Iraq. It's like they don't even want to be liked. Not satisfied with ticking people off with that destruction, they went on Twitter and called the movie Creed a bit of a retread. Yeah, I don't think it deserved any of the nominations. ISIS, now you're over the line. In Powerball news, the jackpot is up to $50 million. Oh, wait, we're not covering that anymore? That's not a thing? Let me rephrase. Today's news outlets and lottery players citywide have declared $50 million. Not that big of a deal. Turns out 2015 was a super hot year. All the fashion and the Kardashians. Oh, wait, sorry. I read that wrong. By super hot, I mean the warmest year on record in the history of the planet. Only one thing we can do. We got to send Pitbull to the moon. Get him off this planet. He's muy caliente. Jamie Foxx saved a man's life. The Oscar winner heard a crash outside his L.A. home and found an upturned car on fire. And acting on instincts honed by working in close proximity with Tom Cruise, he saved the man moments before he was engulfed in flames. So for those keeping score of former In Living Color cast members, that's one life saved for Jamie Foxx and none for Tommy Davidson. Come on, Tommy. In weather, it's cold, but not as cold as the day before. Or remember last week? That was cold. Or 31 years ago? Cold. This, not as cold, but so cold. In sports, the Blackhawks beat the Preds last night to win their 12th in a row, breaking a franchise record. Corey Crawford, not an all-star. All right, enough of this hoopla surrounding the new NHL All-Star game. Select an All-Star team and have them play the Hawks. Done, boom, jing, everybody will love it. The Bulls are hosting the Golden State Warriors tonight. This is the perfect chance for the Bulls to send a message to the NBA and lose by 25. Lance Briggs' Porsche crashed into a Chicago storefront earlier this morning. No word on whether or not Briggs was driving. All we know is that Briggs has changed cars since he drove his Lamborghini off the Edens about 10 years ago. So he's downgraded. That's really all we know. You know what would be awesome right now? I was just thinking about this. Just imagine if the Bears were in the NFC Championship game. Just think about how much fun this week would be. You know, all the players would be making the rounds. We'd get all these great. Did you know Kyle Long eats kale? Feel-good stories. There'd be Bears theme songs and parody raps would be blowing up on B96. Oh, this week would be the best. But instead, the only Bear story? Jay Cutler being inducted into the Vanderbilt Hall of Fame. March Madness watch. The Wildcats of Northwestern lost to Maryland, dropping them to 3-4 in the Big Ten. They're still sitting pretty at 15-5, but tough games ahead, including one against Indiana on Saturday. Come on. Just get to 500 in the Big Ten. It gets you in. Come on, Northwestern. And finally, the dates have been announced for Star Wars 8 Electric Boogaloo. It'll be on Christmas 2017. So there you go, fans. Let's all get crazy, wait for leaked trailers, and freak out when we see Lando Calrissian say, "We're home, Chewie." You know that's going to happen. It kind of makes me think we are indeed living in the Matrix. It just repeats itself. Well, that's the carryout for January 20th, 2016. Hey, your coupon's expired. But you know what? I'll give you the discount anyway. More to come here on The Download. We're going to talk about CPS, whether it belongs in Chicago or should it be run by the state. Also, we'll talk to the author of Defender, how the legendary black newspaper changed America. It's The Download here on WGN. Stay with us. I mean, I guess you got to purchase the journal, right? I mean, I guess you can go. See, the smart aleck in me is already like, well, I'll just go take the shot of Jewel.
Right. Open the freezer box or freezer door, take a picture.
I guess we should ask the marketing department, is there any points for creativity? Because that's pretty creative. Especially if you find a way to remove a couple shelves with nobody seeing, and you got in there and you just smothered your whole body with the journal box.
Yes.
I'm giving somebody an idea, and that's the beauty of this show. We're like the internet. We just exchange of ideas. So you could take that and execute that.
I'm gonna do that. Am I eligible? I don't know.
I don't think you're eligible.
I love that frozen
pizza.
I think you should
do it anyway, and then worry about eligibility.
Yeah,
later.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, you know? I can't go my wife doesn't allow me to go grocery shopping with her because, like, I just get lost in the frozen pizza aisle. I just look at longingly.
Come on.
I love it.
You're just like, what are you looking for? Like, are you just looking for something new? Are you adventurous when it comes to frozen pizza?
No, DiGiorno. I just stare at it and want. I want four cheese. I want it all.
Yeah, to me, I always, whenever I go there, I'm like, there's got to be a better pizza. So, like, when I go, I'm like, well, I like Home Run. I'll eat anything. I'll eat all of them. But I'm like, I've had that. Oh, there's got to be a better. I've had that. There's got to be better. And I'm always looking around, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but none of them are better. They're all the same. It's all the same. At a certain point, you're like, oh, yeah, that just didn't really do anything. Which one did I get again? I threw away the box. No. All right, big show tonight, man. I'm very excited. Eitan Michaeli's here. He's in the green room. We're going to talk to him about his book, about The Defender. We're going to talk with Anthony Mosley from Collaboration, Steve Mosqueda and Sean Benjamin. Mike Fouché's here. And big time at 10 o'clock hour. We finally did it, Pete. We're being very productive here in January. We are setting goals. Mondays is now hashtag the worst.
Yep.
We're going to have stand-ups come in, other comedians, culture vultures that come in and tell us what they think is the worst. And you can win. People won Air Supply tickets on Monday.
Yeah.
And tonight, we're going to start what we're calling character flaws. It's a 10 o'clock hour. That's what we're going to call it. You listen to The Download regularly. You know, you'll hear different comedians on doing bits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I don't want to give away the bits because we like the idea. We pride ourselves that you may think it's real. But in the case, what we want to do on Wednesday nights is we really want to set out that this is a great improv and sketch comedy town. There are so many great performers, whether it be Kate James or Rachel Mason or Susan Messing or TJ and Dave and people who've already contributed things to the show, Pete Gross, others who've done things for us and done bits, including Schadenfreude and all the others, that we want to make a showcase. So Wednesdays at 10 o'clock, we're calling Character Flaws, and that's going to be where characters, improv, sketches, sketch comedians, things like that come in. So we'll book that. We'll make Wednesdays destination radio.
Oh, man. I love it.
Right? It's about time this town has that.
Right.
Because it's amazing to me that there hasn't been that. I mean, we've tried different iterations of different kinds of comedy stuff, but there's no real place to showcase that kind of work. And it's happening on stages every single night here in town. And so, like we said, I mean, even this week, we had Matt Besser on Monday. Matt Besser started doing, you know, shows in the basement of Cafe Voltaire.
Yeah.
And now he's part of the Upright Citizens Brigade, which is one of the arguably the best comedy theaters in the country. So we'll talk about, you know, we'll introduce it. We'll debut it tonight.
Yeah,
at 10 o'clock,
so
and then we'll continue to bring it on Wednesdays, right?
Hey, once the word gets out, too, you know, the windows will be lined with sketch comedians trying to get in on this.
Can't wait. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Hope you're enjoying your night, your Wednesday night. Well, could a newspaper in Chicago be responsible for the Great Migration? Or how about giving voice to a civil rights movement? Or electing the first African-American mayor here in town? Well, of course, I'm talking about The Defender, the Chicago-based black-owned newspaper. There's a new book out from former Defender reporter, Eitan Michaeli. He's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. The book is getting great reviews, and Eitan is my guest tonight. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
It is. I mean, it's amazing to think about all the different historical events, and that's really kind of how you write this book. I mean, the idea of all these huge, significant events in American history and how the Defender played a role in pretty much all of it.
The Defender was there right from the very beginning of the city. I mean, Robert Abbott, the founder of the Defender, got his inspiration for the paper at the 1893 World's Fair. That's really the beginning of the modern Chicago that we know today.
So he came up, tell us about Robert Abbott, because he came up from the South and he came to Chicago to see Frederick Douglass speak.
Yeah, Robert Abbott had a unique background. His parents were both emancipated slaves, but his father, his biological father, died even before he was 1 year old. His mother was a woman with great intellectual ability and a real ambition, and she worked for a newspaper in Savannah, where the family was located. While there, she met a man with a very interesting background who was half German and half African. And he had been born in the United States but reared in Germany and came back after the Civil War, where he identified himself as an African-American. He was light enough to pass, as they said, okay, as they may say. But he identified as African-American, married Robert Abbott's mother, and then did something even more remarkable, which is adopt the young Robert Abbott, who was a short, dark-complected child who might have been held back for both of those things, and, of course, for being African-American in the South,
right,
most of all. But because the Reverend Sengstack, as he became a Congregationalist minister, really gave Robert Abbott a great self-confidence that allowed him to go on and do just amazing things.
Yeah, and it's amazing to think about, because, you know, he comes to Chicago, he goes to the fair, as you said, and he realizes that there's an opportunity here, that it's a couple years later, but an opportunity to put together a black newspaper, because there really isn't any voice for blacks in the South or anywhere in the United States.
Well, this is also a moment where newspapers are dramatically changing. Newspapers until that time had been something like an artisanal process, like a boutique kind of enterprise. They were expensive and they were difficult to produce, such that there were only small quantities of a particular paper available at any particular time. Right as Robert Abbott came to Chicago, newspapers shifted technologically using things called linotype machines, really a kind of a typewriter. And that allowed Robert Abbott to essentially bring a bunch of handwritten pages to a printer and for a relatively low price produce a bunch of issues which could then be sold at 2 cents a copy.
Right.
I should go back just a moment and say that he was inspired to do all this because at that World's Fair, where he was a singer with the Hampton Quartet, he was the Hampton Quartet. If you know Hampton University, which is still today one of the most important historically black colleges and universities in the United States, Hampton back then was really the premier African-American higher educational institution. Booker T. Washington had graduated just a few years earlier than Robert Abbott. And the Hampton Quartet was a fundraising vehicle. This is a time before amplified music, before recorded music. So as the quartet went around the country singing African-American spirituals, they were immensely popular. And because of Hampton's intellectual reputation, Robert Abbott had special access to the so-called White City at the World's Fair. And it was just this amazing atmosphere. Of course, the World's Fair has been talked about many times, but the African-American side of what happened at the World's Fair has rarely been told.
Yeah, talk about that, because that was something that, you know, we know a lot about the World's Fair and the history of that, but you know, it was 1893, so things were not, integrated in any form. Talk a little bit about the fair.
So Frederick Douglass, the escaped slave, abolitionist, friend of Abraham Lincoln, and a civil rights activist who had become known as the Sage of Anacostia because he lived in Anacostia later in life. He was 75 years old, and he is the ambassador. He was a former ambassador to the nation of Haiti. So the nation of Haiti requested that he oversee their pavilion at the World's Fair. Well, Frederick Douglass used this as an opportunity to gather together a new generation of African-American activists and to inculcate them with the civil rights struggle. So people like James Weldon Johnson, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, Ida B. Wells, Oscar DePriest, who would go on to be the first African-American alderman in Chicago and the first African-American.
So he brought them all together.
They were all there. And Robert Abbott was there as a young man kind of experiencing all this. And it also has to be said, you got to imagine, there are Sioux warriors who are part of Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show. There are people from West Africa, Eskimos from the Arctic Circle, Inuits from the Arctic Circle who are called Eskimo. At the World's Fair, along with Irish and German and Japanese and Brazilian, and all of them after 5 o'clock are just hanging out together, and it's got to have been the greatest party ever.
You just? I've known you for a while, but yeah. I, and it's amazing to think that. I mean, this project. I mean, you're a history buff. You like this stuff. I mean, this just has to be great for you to be able to write this book and to collect all this information about something that happened so long ago.
Well, and, you know, I worked at the Defender from 1991 to 1996. And when I walked in the door, radio listeners can't tell, but I'm a white guy, white Jewish graduate of the University of Chicago. I didn't know anything about the Defender when I walked in the door. Literally nothing.
And you were like, yeah, you talk about like it's a black owned newspaper. So so what?
Sure. I was raised in the post-racial era. So to me, you know, an African-American owner was the same as a white owner. It didn't seem to make a difference. When I got to the newspaper is when I started really what became a re-education process. And I started to not just understand what was going on in Chicago, not just understand the history of the Defender, but really get an understanding of race in America.
Well, let's talk. I'm going to take a break real quick. When we come back, we'll talk more with Eitan McKaley, who's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. Got to talk Great Migration because it's – I mean, we were just talking with Danny Davis was on Monday talking about coming up from Arkansas. He's on the other side of the river. And
that's right.
And really the Defender found its first sort of quote-unquote circulation in the South. And it was sort of like, hey, I want to go to Chicago. It's, the Defender's there. Like, it almost like brought people to –
it did.
And it's amazing to think about that this newspaper, this small sort of niche newspaper, was able to start something that historically changed America forever.
Well, Robert Abbott got this vision of doing something for the masses while he was at the World's Fair. Frederick Douglass was telling these young African-American activists that they have to – turned the tide of what was happening in the United States at that time. Of course, African Americans after the Civil War could vote, could participate in politics, got themselves elected to Congress, got elected to local offices as well, could prosper in business. And the white oligarchs of the South really hated that.
All right, we'll talk more about this when we come back here on The Download. Stay with us. Yeah, it's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Eitan McKaley. He's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. Eitan worked at The Defender as a reporter from 1991 to 1996. I loved your passage about questioning Bill Clinton at the Robert Taylor Homes. That's good. That's interesting. But the book is really, and it's getting great reviews, and you're everywhere. I mean, it's great to see. And it really does take this like turn where pretty much every big moment in American history, especially as it pertains to African Americans, the Defender has a hand in it. And you know, we talked right before the break about the Great Migration, and that's when African Americans from the South came up from Mississippi to Chicago and really developed this city that we know. And that was because the paper was being circulated to people in Mississippi, Alabama, the South, and they were getting an idea that Chicago was a friendly place to come.
Yes. Robert Abbott enlisted the help of the Pullman porters, among others. And when I say the Pullman porters, these were the workers on trains who worked in dining cars, right, who worked in the sleeper cars as well, and on an individual basis. So the porters would come to the Defender's office, which at first was in Robert Abbott's landlady's dining room.
And where all good newspapers start.
Exactly, you know, on a dining room table. And the porters would bring newspapers from around the country and go through the papers with Abbott to find articles that could be rewritten for an African-American audience. So this was a kind of wire service back in those days.
Yeah, right.
Also, these porters were learning how to write for newspapers. They were learning how to participate in the production process and really working with Abbott, you know, in that grassroots way. When they would go back out on the trains, they would take bundles of newspapers with them and subscription forms, and then they would sell subscriptions to folks around the country. Now, this has to be underscored for a moment, that hardworking small farmers and sharecroppers and small businessmen in the South earned their dollars with a lot of hard work.
Right.
they did not part with that money easily. And it took a lot to convince them to take out subscriptions to a newspaper in faraway Chicago.
Absolutely.
It was only because of that.
It's almost unheard of.
Unprecedented, yeah. For sure. And Abbott really believed that this needed to be a mass communications vehicle for the national African-American community. So he came up with all sorts of different devices to try to attract them to the paper, mainly with content such as really strong anti-lynching articles that could be read nowhere else in the South, articles that encouraged African-Americans to participate in politics. All that said, Abbott did not initially support the movement of African-Americans from the South to the North because the unions in Chicago discriminated against African-Americans. Robert Abbott knew that himself as a Hampton-trained printer.
I was going to say the Pullman Porters are a great example of that.
That's right. So Abbott said there's no point in coming here if there's no job, if there's no job for you and there's nowhere for you to no way for you to earn a living. What changed was World War I. The number of European immigrants to the United States dropped precipitously. Some even went back to Europe to fight in the respective armies of their homeland. And the demand for American products surged. So the only available labor source in the country was the African-American community in the South, which is, of course, at that point, 90% of the African-American community still lived in the South. At that point, Robert Abbott still did not support the migration.
He didn't. No.
Because it was really just an economic opportunity for folks. And frankly, there were economic opportunities in the South as well. You could go to Birmingham, you could go to Atlanta, you could go to other cities where factories were opening up and needed workers as well. What changed was when Robert Abbott saw that when African Americans left, it hurt the economy of the Jim Crow South. The South.
When it became political.
That's right.
Right.
When he saw that, for example, stevedores left en masse from the Jacksonville, Florida port and caused all sorts of problems because there was just no one to do this skilled labor, that's when he started to get the idea that this is a tool to strike back.
It's fascinating, too, because it really, you know, politics plays a big part. You know, when the African-American population moved to Chicago, created a tremendous sort of, I guess you'd say, voting block, you know. And let's talk about that, because the Sendak family and Abbott and everybody, they were political. I mean, they're political. And I believe in the book, they're Republican.
They are Republicans. Well, in the first half of the 20th century, African-Americans are almost all Republicans. That's the party of Lincoln. The Republican Party, it's sometimes hard to see that today, but was founded to end slavery. And African-Americans were extremely loyal to the party. And it should also be said that the Democratic Party was the party of Southern segregationists. It was dominated by the South up through Franklin Roosevelt's time, so it was not an attractive opportunity for African-Americans. African-Americans who went to Democratic national conventions were actually enclosed behind chicken wire for most of the early part of the 20th century.
So let's talk about what made what was the transition politically from Republican Party to Democrat Party. I mean, when did that happen? And Chicago played a big role in it.
It did. Well, Chicago, by 1919, Carl Sandburg, the great Carl Sandburg, visiting the African-American community in Chicago, rates it as the strongest political unit in the United States. Not the strongest African-American political unit in the United States, but the strongest political unit,
wow,
period.
And that's a big number. There's a big number. I forgot the 50,000, something
50,
like
000,
that.
Yeah.
And the thought was that if you could convince that bloc to vote, you would see a sway in the vote.
Well, yeah, the way
they weren't necessarily loyal to one party or other at this point.
Well, they were especially loyal to the Republican Party, but they were most loyal to those that reached out to the African American community. And anybody who made a sincere effort to reach out to the African American community, Democrat or Republican, had a shot at getting those 50,000 votes, which could elect a congressman, mm-hmm, a mayor, a governor, and in many cases a president as well, by swinging Illinois into one column or the other.
That's so amazing. So what was the impetus to change loyalties?
So by 1928, Al Smith is the Democratic, yeah, nominee. This is the beginning of the ascendancy of the northern branch of the Democratic Party. The defender shifts in favor of Al Smith, mainly because at that point it is so disgusted with the Republican Party, which at that point is trying to explicitly become a, quote, Lily White party. this was something that was really anathema to the African American electorate. And so Robert Abbott, to protest this, swung his support to Al Smith, at least rhetorically.
Right.
At that same election, they were also electing Oscar DePriest, the first African American congressman from the South. From the North. So they wanted to support DePriest, who was a Republican. So they soft pedaled their support at the top of the ticket.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating to look back, especially at that time, and how, you know, from essentially the 1920s, 1930s, the African American vote is pretty much largely swung to Democrat only.
A lot of it really has to be attributed to FDR. FDR wasn't just political in the way that he reached out to the African-American community. He was sincere about it. This is a time when white people were generally not wanting to be photographed with African-Americans, didn't want to have any physical contact with African-Americans. And FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, are constantly with African-Americans, are embracing African-Americans, are shaking hands in a manly way with African-Americans. This alone communicates very strongly that FDR is different from other politicians.
Well, okay, let's take a break, hit the news with Rob. But when we come back, we got to talk civil rights. And I want to spend a little bit of time on Harold Washington, because a defender at that time with Jane Byrne, with Mayor Byrne and Richie Daley, like there's some really great sort of politics back and forth from the chapter on Harold Washington. We're talking with Eitan McKaylee. He's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. We'll have more of this conversation after the news here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Got a great show tonight. Coming up in the second half of the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to talk with Mike Fouché about the CPS bankruptcy brouhaha. Which is all, I mean, I guess, if the mayor is down and out, there's blood in the water, why not attack? I think that's what we're seeing here. I'm not sure that this is a real proposal. I think it's just to put a black eye on the mayor, and we'll talk more with Mike about that coming up after 8:30. Also in the 9 o'clock hour, we'll talk to Collaboration. We'll talk to the drinking and writing guys, Sean Benjamin and Steve Mosqueda. They're from the Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind crew, and they have been doing drinking and writing for years now in the Haymarket Theater behind Haymarket in the West Loop. And then coming up at 10 o'clock, Character Flaws, brand new segment. This is just going to be where we do comedy bits. That's it.
That's great.
My guest, we continue our conversation with Eitan McKaylee. He's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. A really great addition to the already great documented works about Chicago history. But this is one that, you know, I've known about The Defender, and I feel like being in the media, I've known that paper and I've read that paper. But there's so much that I think the regular Chicagoan just doesn't know about the history of this, what really is now a niche weekly. And a lot of it is modern history, man. The Civil Rights Movement, Chicago Freedom Movement, The Defender was right there.
The Defender was Martin Luther King's journalistic guardian for the first few years, really, of the civil rights movement. It started writing about King 2 weeks after the Montgomery bus boycott mm-hmm. began, and within a month or two had already recognized Martin Luther King as a new kind of leader and a very significant kind of leader. They really liked it that he was from the South, that he was a minister, and that he was young and forthright.
And this was done through a series of articles, but really the editorials. I mean, the Defender was much more than just a newspaper that was covering Black America. There was an editorial section, and it was almost a live and die by editorial section.
Absolutely. As with every other American newspaper, there's a firewall between the newsroom and advertising and editorial. But at The Defender, it really was, the editorial section was absolutely critical, because it had it was a newspaper that always punched so far above its weight. It had the ability to really influence people with those editorials. Vote for this candidate. Don't vote for this other candidate. These kind of things were really significant in terms of shifting the electorate because people really trusted the defender.
And it was seen by politicians, a lot of white politicians and people in power, that of a mouthpiece for the black community.
Absolutely. If you wanted that crucial support from the African-American community, you had to go to the Defender. Even as the Defender started to kind of lose its national circulation and kind of become more of a local force, let's say by the 60s, 70s, local politicians knew that they absolutely had to get into the Defender and also into the Bud Billiken Parade, which takes place every summer, which most people don't know the Defender sponsored and created back in 1920.
As a character, right. The Civil Rights part, and I hate to skip over it because it's such a big part, and you can read the book, but the Chicago Freedom Movement, 68 riots, all the kind of stuff that you know, put Chicago in the news and the national news, the Defender was in the middle of. But, you know, keeping going with the politicians, I want to take time to talk about the election in 1983, the Harold Washington running for mayor of Chicago and the Defender's role in that election, because he was running against an incumbent in Jane Byrne and Mayor Daley's son, who now is the second Daley, I guess.
There was second the other retired.
Daley. Yeah, right. Yeah. But the idea being that the Defender played a role in this election.
The Defender was really a voice of conscience in what was the most racially polarized election in the city's history. The Defender, by staying somewhat above the fray, in the sense that it wasn't hysterical, the white newspapers were somewhat hysterical about the potential of Harold Washington becoming mayor. They thought that he wasn't qualified. They didn't like the fact that he had a very minor criminal record. They didn't pay attention, frankly, to his record in Congress or his record as a state senator. They didn't really give that much attention to Harold Washington as an intellectual either.
In general, they just didn't pay much attention to him.
Yeah. Well, with one exception, it has to be said that David Axelrod, the columnist for the Tribune, was the sole voice in any of the white-owned newspapers that really understood what was going on and was telling everybody to pay attention.
You write about it in the book, and there's you quote one of his columns. It was so interesting about the idea of, you know, people, you know, sort of pushing back at this sort of it's our turn. You know, and that was the Harold Washington sort of moniker or slogan. It's our turn, right? And it was amazing to think about. He's like, well, yeah, it is. Because essentially the way he wrote it was he's like, yeah, it is because, you know, every time there's an African-American, they say, you got to play inside the system. Well, they are.
That's exactly
right. And it's time
to
win, right?
That's exactly right. And, of course, we're coming off of years in which there were riots almost every summer in Chicago, where you had confrontations between large groups of young people and the police department. Places were destroyed. Arson happened in a lot of locations. There was a lot of tension over these issues, so it was something that the Defender was trying to tell people that this is not Harold Washington's agenda. He is not going to destroy the city. He is going to take the city in a positive direction. He's going to actually try to dismantle the machine. That's really what Harold Washington was determined to do. He was a product of the machine who had come to realize that it was harming not just African Americans, but everybody.
It's amazing, too, because really where the Defender played the biggest role was when Mayor Byrne said, I'm not going to talk to you guys. Essentially, it was it made a huge, maybe a misstep in that campaign where she just ignored the Defender.
Well, she ignored the Defender, but her surrogates tried to offer the Defender various enticements to endorse her. The Defender exposed those offers and said that we are not that kind of newspaper and we are not going to do anything but expose these kind of shenanigans. And they looked at that as a further mark against Jane Byrne, who, of course, had had an erratic career as mayor and had won initially with very strong support from the African-American community, but had really gone the other way very soon into her
reign. Well, she had done the sleeping at Cabrini Green. She had done a lot of stunts. She didn't seem to be very open and welcoming to the African-American community in her own cabinet and things like that. But and so it did seem like it was time, but that seemed like a slight on Mayor Burns' part that ultimately came and bit her in the butt.
Yeah, and listen, I think all of it would not have – the defender would have endorsed any
Harold,
candidate
yeah, yeah.
that was qualified. They looked at Harold Washington objectively. They said, here is a guy with a long political track record. Here is a guy with a record of decisions and opinions and statements that we can actually review. And when we deduct race as a factor, we see that he's just very simply the most qualified, the most honorable, and the most motivated of the candidates.
We're talking about the defender here on the download. You know, we only have a couple minutes left, Eitan. And I wanted to ask about now, because the defender, you know, over the years, there have been more stories about its management and its sale and the ownership of this you know, historic paper than the work that it's producing. Talk about it, because it's seen better days. It's now back to a weekly. It's been a weekly for a while.
Sure.
And it doesn't have the power it once had.
It's true. And of course, what's happened to the defender is what's happened to newspapers all over the country. The internet makes it possible to deliver news immediately, and it also makes it possible for people to communicate with each other in a way that doesn't require the page of the newspaper to do that. Classified ads or mm-hmm. articles of hometown news, these are all things that are now done on Twitter or Facebook. So the defender lost a lot of its circulation the way that all newspapers are. But I have to tell you that as I started to think of closing this book, I had to say to myself, am I going to predict that the newspaper is going to go away? And I had to come to the conclusion that I don't think it will. I think that as long as there are issues that the defender needs to defend, mm-hmm. the defender will be around. And the folks that are running it today, are doing a great job. They're, you know, they're like we were back in the 90s. They don't have enough resources. They don't have really what they need to do everything that they would like to do. But they love the paper, love the mission of the paper, and are going to do everything they can to get the news out.
You know, last question just about writing this book and you know, putting your time and energy into defining the history of the defender. I read this somewhere in one of the pieces that you did, just about this isn't necessarily a triumphant look at you know, race and Chicago and politics. No. Looking back through this as a historical piece, you see it's hard to celebrate.
I came away from this book understanding that there had been change, but not necessarily progress. That was really the kind of sad conclusion that yeah, we have an African American president. Yes, there are opportunities that were never there for African Americans. But if you're a kid growing up in Englewood today, your situation may even be worse today than it was a generation earlier, for kids a generation earlier.
Eitan Mikaeli is a reporter. He worked at The Defender in the 90s, 91 to 96. He's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. It's a must-read for Chicago history buffs. Eitan, thanks for coming in and sharing your story tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was great. Get a little history tonight. Chicago Defender. There's so much to talk about, too, because I kind of razzed Eitan a little bit about the Bill Clinton's famed, if you remember that, it was 95, maybe? Forgot, no, 94, the World Cup. He came to Chicago, and he did all, and the reporters and the national pool people, and he did the, you know, the thing that you do at that time, where you go to the Robert Taylor homes to tour it. And he goes through, and you know, that's already been sweeped. You know, nothing is how it usually is. And Eitan says it smells like bleach, not, you know, urine. And it was at that time, like, he turned and said, "Okay, I'll take some questions." And Eitan asked him a question about, you know, do you support the sweeps that police are doing in the housing projects? And he said yes. And he talked about safety and people, and it was just and then the national press caught on that this was an interesting story, and they started to ask questions about it as well. And the defender wrote it up, and it became a national kind of story about how the police deal with the housing projects in Chicago, and it's because of Eitan and the defender. So many great stories. I mean, The one thing I didn't get a chance to say is this book's like 600 pages long.
Yeah, it's a...
It's long.
It's a hefty tome.
And it's the one I have, it's a paperback. So like for the last couple of days, I'm a big fan of being able to slip the paperback in the back pocket. You know, it's like a cool look. Especially like when you're on the bus and things like that. You're like, hey, I'm a reader. I'm a reader and I can get this in my pants. So this 600-page jobber, this was a tough one to carry around. You know, I looked much more academic. I had to look like I was in high school, like I was like cradling it when I walked, as opposed to like slipping it in the back pocket like I'm just some cool dude. You know, my To Kill a Mockingbird's in the back pocket. Catcher in the Rye's in the back pocket. The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America, cradle.
That's like George Costanza's wallet.
Right, exactly. This thing is like George Costanza's wallet. It's great, and it's worth the read, but it's long.
If you're walking around, though, with a Catcher in the Rye in your back pocket, that says you haven't read a book since high school.
Yeah, right.
More than with this, you look like, oh, man, you're right on top of the latest.
Exactly. The news. Maybe I could be the guy at the bar, you know, in the dark bar who's reading. At, you know, with his peanuts and his green, like, don't bother me, I'm reading. But it's this book, The Defender. Leave me alone. I read Ayn Rand yesterday. Now I'm going to read The Defender. You know, you wouldn't even know. Or like the bouncer who reads, who's got the, I just love that. Oh, you're educating yourself. That's great. What's the special tonight? Such a jerk. Such a jerk. All right, coming up, we're going to talk to Mike Fouché about the CPS bankruptcy stuff. I got to say, I had a huge breakthrough last week when Mike was on, because we were talking about CPS and the formula for funding. And I always found, and I thought about this today, and we'll talk with Mike about it coming up after the news. The idea when they say, oh, they want to get funding from Springfield, right? Or, yeah, they need funding, school funding. You know what that is? Our taxes. So, like, the idea that it's just, like, if they want, they can get, you know, like they got to get this funding. Like, they're entering, it's a lotto or a grant. Like, they had to write a thing, oh, I hope someone will give us money. No, we give money, right? We give money, and it's their job to allocate that money. So the idea that someone is holding back or saying you pay too much, or you're not paying enough, is kind of like, well, that's what your job is. And so it's interesting that what's happening down there as the formula and the argument over how much money should be allocated and now who should allocate it. So this is interesting. So we talked to Mike. I got some questions about the philosophy and how we do government. I'm getting deep tonight. We're getting deep, Pete. I'm really going to get to the bottom of what's at the core wrong, philosophically wrong with this place, man. So download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight when Patty Vasquez takes over. My guest tonight, Mike Fouché.
Hey, hey.
From aldertrack.com, the subscription newsletter, serving up all things Chicago politics. You know, this week, I mean, today, a huge day. Usually you're on, we're talking about the mayor and the city of Chicago and the aldermen because it's a Wednesday.
Yeah, right.
But today, the thunder stole from downstate. Springfield and the GOP leaders
in
Springfield.
They came up here in order to tell
they
us.
Did. They did, right.
It was very nice.
They had a press conference today saying that they were in favor of taking back CPS from the city.
That's right. Take back CPS.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I mean, you know, what's kind of interesting is that these were basically two leaders. Christine Redonio is from, I think, Western Springs. Mm-hmm. And Jim Durkin is from Burr Ridge. He's the House Minority Leader. She's the House
Senate Minority Leader.
So the Republicans. And you know, they represent people from the suburbs who think of Chicago as a curse word, is really what it is. And there's a very large contingent of people that live in the suburbs that are convinced that Chicago is doing nothing except sucking off their money.
Right.
And just living large, right? And we're you know, just a
well. You and I talked last week at the end of the segment just about how school funding really, in a nutshell, has happened over the last couple of years. And what we've seen is growing budgets at the CPS, but we've also seen sort of a formula for funding and then a handshake deal with the Democratic governor, whether it be Quinn or before him, Blagojevich, that would essentially say, and we'll give you another $200
million. Well, let's be clear here. There are no clean hands anywhere. Last year, CPS passed a fabulous budget where they used 13 months of revenue in order to pay for 12 months of operations. Unreal. I mean, they knew from the beginning that they were running a deficit and that they didn't have an operation that was rationalized, but they did this crazy thing anyway. And so they took a bite out of this year's money, so we're in even a deeper hole this year.
So let me ask you, though, because, okay, the two sides of this, I mean, is we both agree that this is kind of dead in the water. Meaning there's political, and we'll get to the political side of this. You have to get big supermajority of Democrats to go for this, and those are Chicago Democrats. They're not going to do it. But the ideologically, you're talking about Democrats that say the state needs to fund Chicago schools like they fund everybody else and stop acting like Chicago is a curse word. And on the Republican side, they're saying for far too long, for far too many years with Democratic governors, you have messed with the numbers and gotten more on handshake deals than you were supposed to.
So, well, let's start with this. The Illinois Constitution says that the state is supposed to fund 51% of education throughout the state. Pretty much since the Constitution was passed, I think in 1971, it hasn't happened. That hasn't happened ever. There is also a funding formula that was created and used in the state in order to supply funding to all the different states. The state does actually send money to all the different schools, and the funding formula is based on the number of students and a certain amount of money per student. And then there's other things like the number of poor students, number of students that are on the school lunch program that receive, you get extra money if you have more students on the school lunch program in your district. And through that formula, Chicago has always been underfunded compared to many other school districts in the state. And there's also a understanding that Chicago has a disproportionate number of students that are in poverty. So according to the formula and the thinking, Chicago should get more money.
Now, Republicans will push back. You saw Senator Redonio today saying, I question the numbers that Forrest Claypool is putting back, because Forrest Claypool said he wants 25% instead of 20%. That 5% is the $500 million
That discussion is entirely separate from the system that the schools have used for all these years. And the way that we've muddled through in Chicago is that there has either been a majority of the legislature run by Democrats and a Democratic governor, or a Republican governor who was willing to cut a deal and say, all right, we'll get you more money, Chicago, in return you do this for the suburbs. And Bruce Rauner has essentially said, no, we're not going to do that anymore.
We're going to break this.
We're going to break this whole thing, and we're going to tear it all down, and we're going to start all over again. Now,
which to his credit, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, that's what he ran on.
It sounds
he ran on the idea that he's a businessman who's going to fix the troubled sort of business practices of the state of Illinois.
Everyone agrees that the funding system for schools, not just in Chicago but statewide, is totally broken. We're nowhere near sending 51% of schools to schools. Many, many school districts have enormous amounts of property taxes just to be able to pay for the students. A lot of suburban school districts that don't have any commercial districts or any industrial are really crushing.
That's what their tax dollars
go
to.
They have crushing tax burdens. A lot of suburban school districts and small school districts throughout the rest of the state that don't have a lot of commercial or industrial. This is a real serious problem. And so the funding formula is something that large parts of the state really want to address. And then they look at Chicago and they say, well, you guys have plenty of commercial, you have plenty of industrial.
Get the money from Boeing.
Get the money from Boeing, You know, get the money from the Ford plant on the south side or whatever it is that you do in order to take care of it. You guys should be able to take care of yourselves. That is their perspective. The thing, though, is that Bruce Rauner has made it very clear that he has really two things that are part of the Bruce Rauner turnaround agenda. One is that he wants to place a property tax cap across the state. Now, CPS already has a property tax cap, which is one of the reasons why it's in this funding jam. It can't just raise property taxes. This current budget year, they raised property taxes as much as they could, and they got $16 million
extra. To be clear, the property tax that addition that we just had, was none of that goes to the schools.
Right. That was all for the city.
Right.
So the other thing that Bruce Rauner wants to have in the turnaround agenda is to eliminate collective bargaining for government employees. That means teachers.
Teachers union.
Teachers unions. It also means, you know, everybody that works in the city, the streets and sand guys, the cops, the firefighters. He wants to get rid of all that. Actually, he says that public safety unions should not be affected.
Well, that's the political part where he just knows that if you go after a police or firefighters, collective bargaining or pension or anything like that, you're
but
not going to be.
Everybody else, the guys of the water department that drive the bulldozers and all that other stuff, they
and
would
for
no
this
longer
situation,
be,
teachers
and teachers in this case, teachers. So that would that that's there would be an enormous political thing that would change. And the thing, though, is that you would argue, okay, well, if you eliminate a collective bargaining for the teachers and you force them to take a pay cut, how much would you actually save? And when you sit down and you do the math, you're really not going to save enough. The gap that CPS has, now CPS has about a $2.6 billion budget. The gap that it has this year is about $500 million. You're not going to be able to cut enough teacher salaries in order to make that difference.
Mike Fouché is with AlderTrack.com. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and continue this because bankruptcy is getting thrown around again. And this was brought up in the campaign, but it also was brought up right when Rauner took over. I mean, he talked about bankruptcy being an option for townships, bankruptcy being an option for systems and school districts.
Right.
Here he is again bringing it up. What does it mean? What would be the benefit of having a municipal a part of government go through bankruptcy in the city of Chicago? We'll talk with Mike about that when we come back. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Mike Fouché is in studio. We're talking bankruptcy.
Slow jam to bankruptcy.
Are you in need of finding more money?
Oh, yeah.
1-800-BANKER. We need to get Peter Francis Geraci on to talk about the school system.
Mr. Mascara.
So, all right, let's talk about this because this is something that I seem to have seen, I don't know, the 5-10 different articles today about what municipal bankruptcy really means.
Yeah.
And you know, Bruce Rauner, he seems to like this concept mostly because it just means you can get out of contracts that you've already got in place.
So, I mean, the bankruptcy, first thing that everyone needs to understand is that bankruptcy judges are the most powerful people on the planet. When you go into bankruptcy and you go before a bankruptcy judge, the bankruptcy judge can do anything they want, literally. There is an order in which people who have claims on the money for the organization or person that has gone bankrupt go in, and the first group of people that are supposed to get claims are pensions. Mm-hmm. The second group are supposed to be bondholders. The third group are debt holders. So if you take a loan, that's different than a bond. And then the third group is everybody else.
Right. And we've seen how that's worked out for airlines.
Well,
the everybody else is usually the employees.
Well, and actually an excellent example is Detroit. So Detroit essentially went into bankruptcy, not directly, but pretty close to it. And one of the big struggles was who is going to get their money first? Are the pensioners from the city going to get their money first or the bondholders? And there were many, many bondholders. And Detroit has a very large art collection. The art museum in the city of Detroit is owned by the city. And so there was this talk about selling hundreds and hundreds of millions of priceless paintings in order to pay all the debt holders. You know, these incredible public treasures were going to go away. That's the sort of stuff that you go through.
So essentially you go liquid, you pay out everyone that you can with the money that's available,
and everything else
is just negotiated.
That's right. I mean, literally the bankruptcy judge could go to every single CPS school, every CPS building and say, nope, that's got to go, and we're going to pay all these things in order to do that. And you really don't know what you're going to get until you get the drawing of the judge. You have no idea what this person is going to be like and how they're going to view things. So the concept that Bruce Rauner is talking about here can be very, very risky. for the school system. Now, the problem is that a school is different than a business. If a business shuts down, if we lose United Airlines next week, no big deal. There's some other airlines. A lot of people lose jobs. But, you know, it's not a critical component to survival for the nation. There's other airlines.
Right.
If you get rid of CPS, if you eliminate, if CPS decides that they're going to eliminate all of their special ed, that means that all the kids that have a reading problem in Chicago for the next 10 years are going to continue having reading problems for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, you can't really negotiate or, I guess, make them assets like that you would a business. I mean, you can't say the asset is the library.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Sorry,
right.
Kids. You
the lunchroom is an asset.
You can't read
trays.
Charlotte's Web. You're right. Not going to get Charlotte's Web. Sorry.
Yeah,
kids.
It doesn't make sense. And I think that's what's interesting about this is that, you know, as I kind of joked at the top, it does feel political in the way that Rahm Emanuel is really taking it on the chin right now with his political future,
right.
Everything that's happened with Laquan McDonald's police shootings. He just does. And not to mention after passing through the biggest property tax hike in modern history.
Right.
You know, it's an easy target to come after him right now and go, you're doing terrible with CPS. We're going to take it from you.
You're the worst, Rahm Emanuel. I mean, yeah. I mean, all those people in the suburbs are very happy to say Chicago's terrible because it makes them look good to their voters. But let's be real for a moment here. In order for anything to get through the state legislature, it first has to be called up for a vote in the House and in the Senate. Mm-hmm. The way that the legislature is set up is that the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate control whether both Chicago Democrats decide whether or not something is going to be voted on. So these guys are not Senate President Cullerton is not going to call it up for a vote. House Speaker Mike Madigan is not going to call it up.
But they know that. I mean, Senator Redonia knows that. Speaker Durkin knows that. Or not Speaker.
Leader Durkin.
Leader
Durkin. He wishes.
Yeah. Leader Durkin knows that. So this is a little bit of political drama.
It's a lot of political drama. Yeah. It's all it is. Because this is not a serious solution, and it's not a serious thing that's going to happen. So essentially what they're doing is that they're increasing the political heat on Rahm Emanuel, and they're trying to drum up excitement from Republicans that are in the suburbs, because this is what really has to happen, is that Bruce Rauner needs to get more Republicans voting for him and his program this summer or this fall in November in order to take some control of the legislature. Right now, Madigan and Cullerton have veto-proof majorities in the House and the Senate, sort of.
They can't
get their people in line in the House. But certainly it's going to keep Rauner's turnaround agenda from passing at all. And so what the Republicans want to be able to do is make sure that all of their people go out and vote this fall, and that they all understand that if they can vote Republican, they're going to shut down the Chicago machine. That's really what this is all about.
So CPS becomes a pawn in what seems to be a fight between suburban Republicans and Chicago Democrats.
That's absolutely right. And essentially what we're looking at is a scenario where nothing in the Chicago public schools is really going to be solved until at the earliest November in the elections.
Because here we go again, where there is enough money. You know, the bonds will be passed next week. There's enough money to get them through that February deadline.
Yep.
And then there's enough. Well, here comes June. That's all we got to get to. The summer, we don't really spend much because teachers aren't working.
Right.
So we'll deal with this come 2016, 2017.
Well, it's going to have to be dealt with sometime this year.
Right.
So it's going to happen, you know, probably right after the election, assuming Democrats retain control of both houses, which I think there's a very high likelihood that the Democrats will retain control. If you look at the numbers in the elections that are being run, Bruce Rauner really has his work cut out for him. It's going to be hard for them to beat the veto-proof majority in terms of the way that the seats
what
are
I
set
don't
up.
Understand, and I guess this we can wrap it here, but I don't understand. Politically, I get the idea of saying Rahm Emanuel's doing a poor job. We should take over the schools because we can do a better job. But why would the Rauner and Redonia and Durkin and the GOP party here in Illinois want anything to do with trying to fix Chicago schools?
They really don't. I mean, this is just one more opportunity in order to say Chicago is a crummy town and it's run by crummy people. And what you need to be able to do is get behind the Republican program so you can stop these crummy people. I mean, what both sides, the Democrats and Republicans, are totally talking past each other. The Democrats have really set up this enormous fiscal problem over decades of mismanagement. And Republicans are not offering any real serious solutions. And they're not really talking about governing. You know, the Democrats have done a really poor job of governing for the last 10 years. That's why we're in the problem that we have. And the Republicans are not offering any real solutions.
They don't have to.
No, they don't. All they have to do is say, you guys suck. And and so that basically
Illinois
sets
politics,
it up.
You guys suck.
That's our new model. New motto. No longer the land of Lincoln. You guys suck.
You guys suck.
Put it on the license plate.
Mike Boucher is the man behind AlderTrack.com, the subscription newsletter that serves all things Chicago politics. Mike, thanks for coming in and talking about this.
Great to be here.
All right, it's the download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's 9:08, and we're here till 11 o'clock. Yeah, I, as I said, you know, I got so many people who sent me articles in the old inbox. And they would say, a DNA info article, and they say, hey, these two guys walked Western Avenue, and they drank at all the bars on Western Avenue. They spent a weekend or whatever it was, right? And I'm like, well, all right, that's all right. You know, like, all right. Like, you know, and then somebody else is like, hey, did you have those two guys on who drank Western Avenue? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. So I cleaned the inbox, and I finally clicked on the link. And popping up is a picture of you two with Slickman. And it's like sort of like, these guys walked. And it's Sean Benjamin and Steve Mosqueda. And I've known these guys for years because they're part of the Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind crew. It was all for a documentary called The Western Avenue Project, Drinking and Writing. That's the show they do. It's been a stage show. It continues to be a podcast, video. Of course, there's writing involved. It's spearheaded by these two great Chicago performers, Steve Mosqueda and Sean Benjamin. The Drinking and Writing Theater is at the Haymarket Pub in the West Loop. Both met as performing in Too Much Light, and they're my guests tonight here on The Download. Good to see you guys.
Hey, man.
Good to see you, too.
So the best part about this story is that this happened 5 years ago.
5 years
this
ago.
This was 5 years. So why did DNA Info write about your walking up Western Avenue, getting drunk in every bar?
Well, I think we both kept – they wrote a story recently about a group of people that walk up Western Avenue once a month or something like that. So we kept getting I kept getting these texts like, dude, did you see that article? Like, tell them what you did. And I said, yeah, you're right. So I emailed the guy and I said, you think that's cool? Try walking up Western Avenue and having a beer in every bar. I mean, that's
– What was the impetus behind doing this in the first place?
You know, I think we always get together and have some beers in a bar and discuss upcoming show ideas. And I forget what – I think we're just talking about going up and down Western Avenue because it's the longest street and continuous street in any city.
Yeah, and we found that out because we were doing research for the show. We were doing a show all about Chicago. And we started doing research about Chicago and, you know, the history of Chicago. You know. It's incredible. And so we discovered that Western Avenue is like the longest continuous street in a major city in the world. And we're like, we should do something with that. And I think one of us said, let's drink.
I got a better idea. Let's drink it.
So we counted the bars. I think, well, first we did a drive down. We drove down and counted all the bars and went on a map and kind of marked them all out. And then we were like, okay, let's divide this up over four days. And so we did it over Memorial Day weekend. And, you know, I think there's like 64, 65 bars, give or take.
Yeah. And so you found different places where you could crash. That's the important thing. You didn't necessarily do two bars and then go all the way home.
Nope.
And then come back. You mapped it out and you went for it. What was the experience like? I mean, did you told every bar you walked in, you said, hey, I'm doing this thing. What was the reaction?
Well, the task was to have a pint in every bar we went into, which obviously we had more because people met us along the way. But no, we went in and we would tell people. Some people were welcoming. You know, some people when there's drinking involved got a little bit nervous and didn't want us recording because we had a little when we did it back then, it was the flip cams. That already dates us.
You're already dated.
Somebody saw that and said, you guys had flip cams? Were you poor? I was like, no, man. It was a few years ago.
We didn't have any phones. I had a flip phone if I had that. I don't even know.
But some people were impressed by it. Some people were just like, you're out of your mind, or it can't be done. Because a lot of people thought there must be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bars.
So there's 64 bars.
Yeah.
And after the first night, you got too drunk.
I did, yes.
The first night, yeah, was the worst because it's Beverly and there's, you know, 18 bars in a like a 7-block.
So you went south to north.
Yeah, we started 119th and started walking. And even before we got to 119th, we took the train from downtown and we had a couple of like 16 ounces of Miller Lite. Or
then we went into the Sky. What's it called? The Sky Bar?
Yeah, it's called the Sky Bar.
I had a drink
before
we even got to Western Avenue.
Yeah, so we started drinking at 10 o'clock in the morning.
So arrogant. And that was the fun part about this is that you really did start. You had to do full days. So it was like you started in the morning.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
as soon as places would open up, we started.
So, yeah, that's, yeah.
That so the documentary was actually produced. It's online. I mean, it was 2012. It was produced. You guys had an editor put the stuff together.
Yeah, our friend Jamie Budzik, who's a big supporter of drinking and writing, we gave him all of this footage and said, hey, do you think you can... And he actually, we stayed at his house one night and he knew we were doing all this. But we said, hey, we got all this footage. You think you can do something with it?
It was like 20-something hours of drunken rambling.
It's on flip phone. It's flip camera. But,
yeah, so Jamie put a lot of time into creating this video, which I think it's pretty good. He did a great job.
Now, when you guys think back on this, I mean, now getting press, I mean, the story's kind of going viral and the fact that people keep sending it to me. I guess I'm the arbiter of viral. But you know, when you look back on it, I mean, would you do it again?
No.
I don't think I can do it again, actually.
Physically, I couldn't, no.
Yeah, it was a lot of drinking, but it was a lot of hours, you know? It was like, I'm usually in bed by 10 o'clock now. I mean, we were up, you know, midnight, 1 o'clock, 2... We were partying, you know. It was a long haul, but I don't think I could do it again.
After the first night, I was just ill, and the next day I got up and I think we went over to the library in Beverly and just kind of fell asleep on some couches, and I was like, "This is not going to happen." But we pulled it together.
Yeah, we went to Top Notch Burger and had breakfast.
Yeah, good place.
It's a great place. And then the second day we started, it was like 85 degrees. And we were hungover, and it was hot as hell. And there aren't very many bars all the way up through the 80s,
and you had
70s.
You had to walk
the whole time.
It's all car dealerships.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
lots of car dealerships on West.
Totally.
There are no bars in there? I'm sure you could go into a drawer in the Ford dealership on 78th.
Yeah,
let me just ask you, what did you learn about Chicago doing it?
Oh, that was a long pause. Did you not learn anything?
No, what I was going to say was, which is true, I was thinking about having a beer. No, what I was thinking was in our video, Bill Savage, professor from Northwestern, he was a big supporter as well. But he kind of laid it out about the difference between the North Side and the South Side, and that there really isn't a difference. The only difference is they root for the Cubs and the South Side root for the Sox. But every bar that we went into when we told them what we were doing, they all had the same they were all excited. They all, you know, you got to be kidding me. And they would buy us shots or beers. And even though we didn't want them, you had to do them.
Yeah, right.
And it was just an enthusiasm that just went all the way up Western Avenue. And I think that's kind of one of the things I learned is that, you know.
Chicago is Chicago.
Yeah, gee, it is. It is. And, you know, we're all, like Bill said, you know, we're all Bears fans, you know.
And I think one thing I'll say I learned is that, and I say it in the video, that every neighborhood you go to, you know, Chicago is a neighborhood city, and every neighborhood was like, oh, how bad was it in that last neighborhood? And, oh, it's going to get bad up this way up north, but here you're good. But so it's funny how everybody's like so proud of their neighborhood, but they're like, that neighborhood down there, you probably got mugged, right? And I'm like, nope. And that's, it was really interesting because we had no issues at all.
There was this one guy, he had these really cool boots on, and he, spoke only Spanish, and I can speak broken Spanish, and I think he thought I was making fun of his boots, but I actually said I love your boots, and he wanted to kick my butt.
He knifed Sean. Yeah, that's good stuff.
Next time it'll be you, Steve.
Sean Benjamin, Steve Mosqueda, they're part of the drinking and writing crew.
that has the theater behind the Haymarket Pub on the in the West Loop. Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to know more about what you guys are up to. We'll talk about the philosophy behind drinking and writing and all the good stuff here on The Download. Stay with us. 26,000 blocks west of Western, straight Paul Damon. I wasn't playing. That's Western, Western Ave, Western Avenue, BNC, Western Inn, Michael Western, Burno to season 10. West Germany, Western, 36K East. During the taste, you can get a job sweeping up streets. Take Western to Florida, take Western to Greece, take Western from MCY. That's on right, the take Western.
That's awesome.
Yeah. All right, it's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin, Beats by Zim, Beats by Pete Zimmerman. He's the one throwing out the Serengeti there.
Good job.
Yeah. Talking in studio, drinking and writing, Sean Benjamin, Steve Mosqueda, the longtime performers and creators of drinking and writing. The theater is behind the Haymarket and West Loop. You guys met doing Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind. What I love about your work is that you found a way to philosophically tie together what you do and what you did and drinking. And yes. and I've seen the show and I love it. And you guys talk about the great writers and their sort of connection and almost, I guess, inspiration from alcohol.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that was, you know, when we first came up with the idea, we were drinking and we wanted to do a show about our favorite writers. We started with Bukowski and we were going to do a show called Book on Ice. And it was going to be some kind of Christmas show. And then the fun part about doing these shows is all the research. I like doing the research. And so as we researched the project, it was, you know, we found all these other writers who had drinking in common. And then we thought we had to incorporate all of them. So that's how it kind of started. And I remember the first time we did the show, the idea was we sat at the bar with the audience and drank with them.
I've seen that show, yeah.
So I remember I was a little afraid because I thought, yeah, I'm going to start drinking. I'm going to forget lines and what's going to happen? And then as we progressed, it went from, you know, just a half a beer for the show to a full beer for the show. And then it was two beers and then three. And it just got more comfortable. And now we've been doing it for so long, it's almost unheard of that I don't have a couple of beers before the show.
Well, you guys have had success. I mean, you did the show. I saw the show up at the Neo Futurarium or right around there in Andersonville.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever the bar was at the
Tease.
Time. Tease, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, you came downtown. You're in the West Loop. You've got this space. And it's not only evolved your show, the drinking and writing show, but you've created more. You've created an ensemble around it. You've created different alternative type shows that play at different times. Talk about the evolution and growth of drinking and writing.
You know, when we first did the show Drinking and Writing, we thought it was just going to be this intimate show where we talk to people sitting at a bar and we have a few beers with them. But it took off. We were just packing the house and we thought we've tapped into that romantic idea about the drinker and writer. Even though the first play did end with the lives of these writers about what happened to all of them. It's
right.
Not good.
It's not good. It's never good.
Yeah. But then we were like, we got to do another one. We just did these series of drinking and writing shows about, you know, Prohibition and about...
hangovers and...
Yeah, the hangover. We decided to like experiment on ourselves and do to cure a hangover, and we just started trying all the old wives' tales about what could cure that. And then we just kept doing more and more shows. It's not all of them were in the same vein of us sitting talking to the audience.
Right.
Some of them are just regular straight up plays. Now that we have our own space, I think it just kind of opens up what we can do. I mean, the Neo Futurist Theater, obviously, it's a great theater company, and a long running show, but. You know, we can't just do whatever we want there. So.
But here, you can.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And now we have this this new show that we started last April. It's called Versus. It's something versus something else. It changes. We try to do it once a month, and the subjects change. So right now the subject is the best of times versus the worst of times. Next month it's going to be Catcher in the Rye versus Ham on Rye. Upcoming will be IUD versus DUI.
And the idea being that there are different performers on either side of the issue?
Yeah, there's two teams on either side of the issue, two teams of three. And there's six rounds, and it's a battle of art. So they produce these short pieces, they're fantastic young writer-performers up and coming in Chicago, and I feel real lucky to have them working with us because they're very enthusiastic and they're fantastic writers and performers.
Well, would you guys? I mean, I'm trying to think of the offhand. 2005, maybe 2004, when you guys first did your show.
2002.
2002.
Yeah.
So I mean, you're talking 14 years now of doing this. What I'm assuming when you guys set out to be a fun side project. I mean, it was a great show and it was cool, but it felt like it was neo-futurist ensemble members doing something fun and then they're back. But you guys have made your names and careers on drinking and writing. Talk about what's next for it. I mean, do you guys see yourself like staying with this concept and working together into the immediate future?
I think so. I think that, like I said, we have a lot of new people that are interested in what we're doing. And, I mean, my goal, my ultimate goal would be to, have a bar. One side is a bar, the other side is the theater. And the theater would be a dedicated theater with taps and, you know, a full bar, where we could do our show. We've kind of been a rogue theater company where we get to do shows in bars, and that's a bit challenging sometimes because business comes first as opposed
to the
arts. But
there's something just even romantic about the concept of this sort of interactive theater in a bar. I mean, when it comes to Chicago.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a lot of shows in the back of bars, and that relationship with the room and the idea that you really do have to command attention. There are other things that people want to do, like watch TV or drink or talk to their friends. Yeah. It's a different kind of performing than the sort of set. You sit in the seat and you watch us perform.
Well, it's funny. Last night we did. I had a show. It was last night at 8 o'clock. There was a guy. We have a bookshelf. It's the drinking writing bookshelf. And during one of the plays that I was doing, he pulled a book off the shelf and started reading it. And I didn't notice it, but Grace Murphy, who's she's one of the co-directors of the show. She walked out of the room because she was going to yell at him. And I didn't notice it. Otherwise, I would have grabbed the book out of his hand and threw it against the wall and said, pay attention to me, idiot. But that happens all the time. You know, there's always people on their cell phones or whatever. And I mean, it's just part of the show. And as hard as it is, it just I'm used to it.
Yeah,
I've become accustomed to it.
To me, I've always felt like it's a certain type of performance. It's not the same as being – when you talk play and what you guys do, you know, to do that in a neo-futurarium, they came to see that. There's nothing else to do. They're watching.
Right.
When you're in a different setting like the back of a bar, it takes a different kind of performance.
You know, one of my favorite – actually, this just ties into you. One of my favorite audience participation moments we didn't plan was Sandy – Marshall had brought us out to was it Metropolitan?
Yeah, that's right. Metropolis. Yeah,
Metropolis. I think there's a brewery, Metropolitan. But but we were doing a show in the bar there, and this guy just kept talking and talking through it, and he was just being just too much, and he finally came up and sat with us. But the funny thing was, he was drunk and out of his mind, but he started like quoting Kerouac and all these great writers.
It made the show better, right?
And then afterwards, people in the audience was like, he's kind of the town drunk. He wakes up in our yard occasionally and stuff. And we're like,
well.
But for another group, it probably would have completely destroyed their show. But we were just like, this dude's part of the show
and
now.
I'm going with it. I mean, it feels like you have to be a certain type of performer or almost a veteran in the way that you have to go ebb and flow with that kind of concept. I've had so many, when we used to do shows, a shot in the back of the Gallery Cabaret.
Yeah,
you know, place would be packed, and it'd just be, you know, a lot of young people, hipster types that were, you know, like shoulder to shoulder to watch. But the one town drunk somehow made his way to the stage, and he stands up and he grabs a mic out of a performer's hand, and it becomes part of the show, and you got to roll with it. And there's something about that I find, you know, almost, I don't know because I don't know the other towns, but it seems uniquely Chicago.
There is a certain thing that happens here in Chicago, but
very few performers have like bounced the audience. Like, I think we were doing a show at the Hop Leaf upstairs, and this guy was getting out of hand and saying, I don't remember what he's saying, some anti-Semitic remark
or something.
And Steve was like, boom, right out.
The audience was cheering
and happy, and we're like,
it's part of the show.
Kick somebody out, and people are happy.
Well, you know, you guys have done so much for, you know, for that Andersonville community and, you know, being able to put shows on, like you said, at Teaser, at Hop Leaf, and even what you do now in the West Loop community, which is not known as a theater district at all. That's a bar and restaurant area.
Right.
But your relationship as drinking and writing to drinking, I mean, as you sort of look back at the 15 years you put into this, I mean, has your relationship changed with alcohol?
There's a big pause there again, John.
Yeah, I take it a lot easier now.
It's funny. No, it's funny. I used to be more of a binge drinker, like not drink during the week and then on the weekend go crazy. Now I think I kind of spread it out a little bit. So I'll come home from work and have a few beers and that's good enough. But I do it, you know, three or four times a week. So I like to think that I have a good relationship good. With alcohol, you good. Know.
Well, I just don't want to see you guys end up at the end of the writers at the end of the show and us. Sean Benjamin, Steve Mosqueda, they're the guys behind Drinking and Writing, which you can see at the Haymarket. The Drinking and Writing Theater is right behind there. And their story in the DNA Info from 5 years ago that was just published this week about walking drinking Western Avenue, I guess is the best way to put it.
Saturdays at 4 o'clock
yep.
is Versus, and Tuesdays at 8 o'clock. And you can go to drinkingandwriting.com and find out more information.
There you go. Steve, Sean, good to see you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's that time of year again for the annual Sketchbook Fest, which is a show focusing on sort of short theatrical scenes, sketches put up by the Chicago theater company Collaboraction. But you know what? This year is bittersweet. After 15 years, this show is being put to bed. This will be its final year on stage at the Chopin through this weekend. When it's all said and done, 240 theatrical premieres over a 15-year period. It's one of the best festivals in Chicago, and I personally am sorry to see it end. Joining me tonight is Collaboraction Theater's artistic director, Anthony Mosley, and one of this year's performers, Gary Simmers, who's going to perform his piece, Overnight Parking Ban. Anthony, Gary, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Why quit?
We're not quitting. We're dying.
Oh, no.
And you know, our culture doesn't handle death well. But in other cultures, you know, it's like this celebrated special thing, especially if you have the foresight and the ability to plan it.
Right.
And spend it with the people you love and look back at all you've done together. And, you know, it's like we had this idea to bring something to the Chicago theater community and to Chicagoans to make theater exciting and bring it to new audiences. And we not only did we do that, but we fell into this vortex of the talent of Chicago theater and the amazing audience that you know keeps it alive.
What I love about the sketchbook is you know there's a lot of sketch comedy in Chicago. Not always the word sketch gets thrown around, and you'll have festivals for that, you'll have festivals for improv, that sort of thing. But this was theater. And it was theater in a way that you would be premiering 3-minute, 4-minute, 5-minute plays. The creativity, the amount of actors and directors that were involved in this, it really felt like you were curating the best that Chicago theater had to offer. And it was brilliant.
You know, we've got world premiere submissions from some of the greatest writers of our times. And some of them wrote their first plays with us. You know, Brett Nevue, we premiered his play, Ellen Ferry. We've had world premieres from amazing writers. But for us, it was never about the sketch. We were just silly. We didn't really think about sketch comedy. For us, it was actually about a sketchbook.
Right.
A place where a theatrical artist could just sketch.
Yeah, it's not a full book. It's a sketch.
It's a sketch. Right. And it's a doodle. And we could take huge risk in our sketch. And it might never become a play. But if we build 16 of these together, we band them together, and then we create an event, a place where young people of urban, diverse upbringing wanted to come together, which really harkened to the whole 90s warehouse scene and the parties and the events that used to happen, and then bring visual art and music. We thought, for me, I was a finance major at Notre Dame, and I fell in love with theater in the studio, two actors. And I was like, that is transcendent. And I learned so much by losing myself in that. How can I bring that to my other peers at like Radiohead and Metro?
Well, let me ask Gary. You know, Gary, we're going to hear from your piece coming up here. Mm-hmm. We'll do it right after the break. But why want to be? Do you want to be involved in Sketchbook?
Well, you know, I guess to dovetail on what Anthony was saying, it's really fun for an actor because like a. It's like 8 minutes max. Usually you meet two or three times. You're kind of throwing some things together. And, you know, and it's one thought. It's one beat. It's one thing that you're going to do. And some of them, you know, if people were to come out and see it, it's really ridiculous. There's a a play by Beth Henley that she wrote particularly for this, where just one thing happens and it takes 8 minutes. You know what's going to happen. And as an actor, sometimes that's really exciting. It's fun. It's you're in, you're out. It's a high risk, high reward, yeah. You know, low
cost. There's always, the ones I've seen, there's always been this play on staging and you play off the fact that it's short. You know, maybe it's something where there's just a lot of moving parts for something that's only 8 minutes long. But there's a lot of creativity that goes not just into the actual work, but the staging of it.
We always try to challenge the way in which an audience can experience theater. And for me, theater is life, so you can experience it anyway. So let's get our theater artists thinking and challenging that. So the audience can be surprised, be kicked out of their seat, have to crane their neck, you know. And so we've always wanted to play with form. Because it's a sketchbook, so you should doodle and go for it, you know? And so we given that canvas, we have seen and been honored to bring to life some amazing shows.
All right, Anthony, you've been involved with it for 15 years. What will you take with you from this? What are the things that you'll remember from 15 years of Sketchbook Fest?
I mean, I think a couple things. Of course, one is just gonna be the people. You know, the you could never place a value on the experiences I've had with the number and amazing Chicago artists that I've been able to hang out with and make work with and watch and learn from. You know, thousands of them. And so that is just something that has shaped me and nurtured me in ways I'll never be able to separate from who I am. And then I think the concept that if you have an idea and you work hard and you surround yourself with great people, you can do anything you want. And it can manifest itself around a community. So for me, you know, it's like we did a 1 year festival and we had a 15-year run. Mm-hmm. And the 15-year run is coming to an end. And we're going to get off the treadmill and we're just going to just let it stop.
Well, there's something great. I mean, you said it at the top, but there's something great about the way theater and people who are in theater view ends, because a run ends. Whether you're the best Hamilton show that's on Broadway, or you know, or the off loop theater in front of the laundromat, it ends.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, it's how you deal with that sort of end that makes you a great performer or theater artist.
Yeah, and the show ends, and the scene ends, and the monologue ends, and the breath ends, and so. Being the people that care the most about time, we wanted to just bring it together. So that's why we went back to the Chopin Theater. We brought Wesley Kimmler, the amazing abstract expressionistic artist, John Cabrera, the co-founder in from Los Angeles to direct Beth Henley's play, my wife, Sandra Delgado, Jeremy. It's time travel over there at the Chopin Theater right now. People are bumping into each other and they're like, oh,
that's
wait,
great.
Is this 08 or 12? Oh, wait a second. It's so...
All right.
It's I think that so it's made it a sacred thing that's happening. You know, it's and that was what the best theater is always sacred. So there's a thing that's more than any one show or any one person. It's all of the people that have helped make it a rite of passage. And don't worry, we've learned how to do this. We know the power. The energy will reincarnate itself.
Yeah. Well, and, I mean, Collaboration is not going anywhere.
No.
You guys have great shows. We talked this summer about a great show you were doing. There'll be more. Let's take a break. We come back. Anthony Mosley. And we'll get a live performance of one of the plays from Gary Simmers, just a cutting from it. It's a download here on the WGN. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. My guests in studio, Anthony Mosley and Gary Simmers, both Collaboration. Anthony is the artistic director. Gary is performing in this year's Sketchbook Festival, the final Sketchbook Festival. 15 years of this great festival in Chicago. It's returning to the Chopin Theater on Division, Division and Ashland, playing through Sunday. The last show is Sunday at 5:30. You got to go see it. I'm going to try to sneak over there and see it because I feel like that's a part of my... I've been inspired by the work that you guys have put on and the theater artists have come through, because it really is great. It's also great for me selfishly because I love short stuff. 8 minutes. 8 minutes. All right. So, Gary Simmers, you're going to perform a part of your piece called Overnight Parking Ban. What do we need to know about it?
We're at the Sacramento tow lot, and just like the title says, the overnight parking ban is in effect, and this gentleman has indeed been affected by that.
So, all right, yeah, let's hear. This is from a piece, overnight parking ban, which you could see at Sketchbook this year.
How long you been waiting? Well, it's a racket is what it is. I mean, no parking, 2 a.m. to 7 a.m., December 1st to April 1st, or when the snow is over 2 inches. You can't put a snowflake sign 10 feet up on a light pole, expect people to read it. But no, we see the snowflake. We assume it's some sort of decorative, holiday-oriented thing. But no. It's Chicago's freaking draconian overnight parking regulations. Better not park there past 2 a.m., in case the plows need to get through. God, look at us. We should be at work. So we're standing here in line in the Sacramento tow lot waiting on the... they just called you. Yeah, you're up. Oh, boy. I get to be next. Lucky me. Overnight parking ban due to possible snowfall. According to Tom Skilling, it was 68 degrees last night, so I am pretty sure that my minivan was not disrupting the workflow of the snowplows because none of them left the garage last night. No. Their drivers are all back at the depot using the rock salt to rim their margarita glasses while they watch TV. Well, that and the meter deal. I mean, who lives here? Who is the city for when a man can't park overnight in front of the drugstore in his own neighborhood? I'm not inconveniencing anybody. I was not blocking the public way. Nobody's doing a drive-through at 2 a.m. to get aspirin from my local pharmacy. The pharmacy, which I patronize in lieu of the 24-hour CVS over on Chicago, because I believe in supporting local business. Yes, I do. God, there's no place to park on my street. Nobody in my street knows how to park. You leave half a car length between yourself and the corners. So what? I'm just supposed to drive around all night long looking for parking, spewing out tons of greenhouse gases. I park there with my community's best interest in mind. But no. Apparently the best interest is to give a $150 ticket to a working man who can't afford to buy a parking spot instead of the jerks in the BMWs. Oh, the out-of-state plates? Well, they don't even pay for a city sticker. Forget that. What? Oh, excuse me. It's my turn. Yes. 1994 Plymouth Voyager Red. Parked on Western at Potomac on the west side of the street. Do I pay you or... No, I go this way. Okay. But is she going to give you my receipt or... No. Well, do I get the keys from you? No. Wait. I'm sorry. I still have the keys. I'm just a little disoriented, you see, because, I should be at work right now. Instead of taking the mythical South California bus down to the ghetto car tow lot impound processing dignity-free BS center, where I got to stand in line for a half an hour, and there were two guys in front of me. Hooray! Hooray for city bureaucracy. So what's the next rung up on the ladder for you? Is there a fancy tow lot downtown where you don't got to do all this menial stuff because it's all computerized and they have fancy freaking snacks? Yeah, all right. I'm sorry. I'm a little frustrated with the whole situation, you see, and... Well, the money, it makes a dent. Thank you very much.
Woo! A cutting from Overnight Parking Ban, you call it a play, right?
Short premiere play. By Joe Zero.
Very talented Joe Zero.
And the actor Gary Simmers, who performed it tonight. Here he'll be performing as part of the Sketchbook Festival, which is on stage at the Chopin, the 15th. And last, Sketchbook Festival. I'm trying to get you to cry, Anthony. So, Anthony, let's talk about this because, that's a great piece. It's great because, you guys asked me, you know that band. I'm like, yeah, I know. Right away, you bristle at the idea of Pete shaking his head. Everybody out there listening is like, yeah, we've all been a part of that. We've all stood there on Sacramento. So talk about, there's that part that's relatable, and that's a big part of what the Sketchbook's about.
Gary was in the first Sketchbook.
Yes. I have a better costume this time around. Yeah, I get to wear my own clothes. No, I was in this play. It was called Rough Cut. Okay, and the decision was made that I should have like on a hospital gown and you know be in a wheelchair because I had like skin cancer and they had to wire me because I had to have this electric light and everything. So everyone else is sitting around having a really great time in the green room doing nothing and I'm sitting there in a hospital gown, you know, in a wheelchair. So yeah,
and at the first sketchbook. Our video designer got his car towed from the overnight parking van two nights in a row because we were working late nights. So, you know, and that's kind of this whole sketchbook is kind of about bringing everything full circle.
What are some other stuff that we that you can explain to us that'll be part of sketchbook this year?
Well, I have to tell you about the show I wrote and directed called Blink with David Desmalchian, who's come in from L.A., to do the show. He was in Dark Knight, Ant-Man, in his own film, The Animals.
That's right.
My wife, Sandra Delgado, is in that show with him. And it's kind of my love letter to Sketchbook. And it's the finale piece. And it deals very much with the here and the now and death and love. We also have another piece called Spanks You Very Much.
Okay.
And this is it's a 50-woman... choreographed.
Wait. 50 women?
50 women doing...
50, 5-0.
5-0. It comes into the theater like it's a stampede of power. it's like the show I could watch. You would never not want to watch it. I've seen every time they... It's like, most people are like, oh, theater, I'm going to be bored.
No.
Spanx comes to town and you sit there and smile. It's about female empowerment and you know
Spanx.
Yeah,
in some form, I'm assuming, right? I'm
Spanx,
assuming.
Yeah. And it's really incredible. And we have the balcony scene from I Heart Juliet from the Q Brothers. So we're getting a hip hop Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet. We have this great show by Beth Henley, directed by John Cabrera, the co-creator of the festival, and she's coming into town tomorrow, which is really exciting. And Wesley Kimmler, the painter, actually takes a pie in the face in that show. I'm just going to ruin it right now. No, because there's a lot of people that want to see Wesley get a pie in the face in the art world, and I want to sell tickets to that.
Right.
I'm going to just
always a promoter.
And I could tell you, but there's nothing like seeing it, especially when he has his chartreuse suit on.
Very nice suit. Yeah. No doubt about that. Yeah.
Well, the show is at the Chopin Theater, which is on Division and Ashland, right at where Milwaukee, Ashland, Division come together. Great theater, great festival, the Sketchbook Festival. It's 15th and final year. You can see it on stage. When does it start? Starts tomorrow night?
We have a 15-year celebration tomorrow night. Uri Lane is our special musical guest. We have a reception stage before the show. It's the Death Program. There's a show Friday, the Life Program. We have Environmental Encroachment, the costumed marching band jamming with us. They are bonkers. And then Saturday we do the full thing at 7 and 9, the Death Program at 7, Life at 9. And then Sunday we do the finale. And we have at 3 o'clock, we do the Life Program. We have a Connie's Pizza, free pizza break.
Sure.
In between shows.
There has to be one of those.
Koval whiskey is giving everybody a shot. And then we do the final shows at 5:30. We do awards afterwards, and then we have a party.
That's it.
It's just, hey, the afterlife is going to be sweet. You know, I'll never, ever... forget these amazing moments and the value of this. We have this incredible community and we all know it, but we don't because we're in the middle of it. And other communities and other times will look back at this and they'll be like, wow, it was going on. You know, so it's just to be able to serve that and be a part of that is, that's all you look for as an artist, is people to work with. And people to inspire you. And then the city has the drama. You know, it really does. It has the landscape and the poverty and the...
And the overnight parking van.
And the overnight... Yeah. Exactly.
Anthony Mosley is the artistic director for Collaboration. Gary Simmers is in the show. He's an actor. We just heard his work. Thank you both for coming down and talking, and great good luck with the final week of Sketchbook.
Thank you so much for having us, and we hope people help us pack the house this weekend.
It's just a character flaw.
It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tonight we try a new concept for the 10 o'clock hour. We've decided that we'd like to honor some of the great performers and writers and comedians that are here in this town. It's amazing how much talent we have available in Chicago and how much of it is available to this show. So starting tonight, we're going to use Wednesdays at 10 o'clock for a new segment called Character Flaws. In it, we're going to bring you sketch comedy, characters, bits, of course, improv. It's going to be a fun ride. So sit back and enjoy. I'll host it and participate a little bit, of course. Yeah, this is a little bit of what I do. Okay. As a matter of fact, tonight we'll bring you comedy from Schadenfreude, the Chicago sketch group that I've been involved with for over 15 years here in town. So that means we're going to hear from Adam Witt, Kate James, and Sandy Marshall, regulars on the show that you've heard throughout the time. They're going to come back, do some stuff tonight. So let's do it. It's called Character Flaws, an hour of fun and games in the theater of your mind, here on The Download on WGN. Well, you know, it's just after 10 o'clock, so you know what we need to know? We need to know what's on the news. I mean, that's really what's competing, you know, with The Download, the 10 o'clock news. So I think it's appropriate to start the hour with the 10 o'clock news at 10 on Channel 10, a promo with anchor Don Braunschweiger. Don, thanks for joining us. What's on the 10 o'clock news at 10 on 10 tonight?
Thank you very much, Justin. Tonight at 10 on the 10 o'clock news at 10. Debate drought. America enters day three of a forced fast. Americans desperate for the same opinion stated differently reaches critical mass. Will the National Guard be called in to debate whether the Bible should be taught in schools? Find out tonight. And war. Now that Star Wars is no longer king of the box office, 10-10 at 10 will keep you on top of the latest cinema trends and showcase some fun costumes your kids can wear this Halloween from The Revenant. And lottery fever. Do you have it? Does anyone you know? We'll show you how to spot the signs and find out how susceptible you are to catching it and how easily it can lead to lottery murder. Also, we'll take the fun out of sports. The Super Bowl may seem like a fun game of pigskin, but we'll meet some local pigs who aren't laughing one bit, Tom Brady. Then 10-10 at 10 gives you the lowdown on politics. Does Hillary Clinton have what it takes to be America's first president who's named that? And controversy. Donald Trump says something so inflammatory, he's sure media outlets will take the bait. Well, 10 News will see about that in part 17 of our 45-part series. And my coffee cup. Who took it? I put it in the drying rack, not in the washer. It has the words, journalists do it on the front page, written in bright red. I just don't see why there would be any confusion. We'll have all this and weather on the 10, sports on the 5s, traffic every single minute in the time right now. It's 10:15, 16 at your source for all the time, news, sports, weather, traffic, poetry slams, stamp collecting, emojis, and events so current you'll swear they just happened. The 10 o'clock news, Toshiba teleprompters. Oh, sorry, read too far.
There you go. Adam Witt, Don Braunschweiger, the 10 o'clock news at 10 on 10, giving us a promo because everybody wants to know what's on the news, right? Adam Witt is a performer, of course, from Chicago, lives in Los Angeles right now. We'll have more coming up. Protest organizer tells us how to effectively get people to come out to protest, and we got to check in with Wrigleyville residents about the latest. The Cubs are not going to be able to secure Addison and Clark on game days. The city said no, there still will be traffic. And Wrigleyville residents, well, maybe not residents, but Wrigleyville fans are mad. Stay with us. It's Character Flaws on The Download.
I just want a bit part in your life. I just want a bit part in your life.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, you know, protests continue over all sorts of social issues. You're seeing it pop up, and it seems like every weekend here in Chicago there's something happening downtown around the area. One person who's been a part of this has been local student, college student Jenna Thompson. She's been organizing protests and doing things from her campus. With us now to explain how these protests come together, it's the Download's protest organizer, Jenna Thompson. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this because, you know, I'm amazed at how you get people out. How do you get the message out that there's going to be a protest?
That is a great question. I feel like growing up in Winnetka, I was exposed to a lot. And so I have this responsibility to give back. So I enjoy social protest, right, as a way to keep people in line. We are the watchdogs. Who's watching the watchdogs, right? So the first key is to sort of reach out and get a community that is supportive, okay, excitable, and ready to take action.
Okay, well, that, yeah, all right, that's where we're at. Mm-hmm. So how do you get those people who may be willing to, right, come out to a protest?
Right. Well, first of all, you want to find them, right? Because you want people that are, like, ready to engage. You want people that are going to show up, right, people that have a voice and an opinion.
No, okay, so let's say you got all that, mm-hmm, but how do you get them to the protest?
Couple ways. Social media, yes, but you have to get specific. So, like, for instance, I might start a Twitter handle for a specific protest that I am forming, and then I invite people to follow me at that Twitter handle. And then I might tweet something out about the protest, and I might ask my followers to retweet. And then if they retweet, their followers then see that tweet. And then maybe somebody will then start to follow the original handle. Because you want people that are, like, excitable, people that are, like, fed up, people that want to make a difference.
Right, right. No, okay, well, Twitter just being one of the areas, I mean, can you use other, like, the Snapchats and Instagrams?
Absolutely. Facebook, huge, huge for us. So what you want to do is start a group, you know, a Facebook group, sure, or a dedicated page. And what you want to do is, like, go to the top right-hand corner of that page on Facebook, uh-huh, and find the little thing that says start a Facebook group, uh-huh, and then you click on that and it'll ask you, like, what do you want to be called? So then you'll name it something that's going to invite people that are proactive, people that have a say, people that are, like, wanting an outlet, right? So you want to pick something that ignites that, something like protest group or group of protesters or protest coming or this is the upcoming protest.
Okay. Moving, let's get to when you're actually at the protest site, mm-hmm, and you're organizing and you're one of the speakers. What do you do to effectively protest when you're there, when you're in the moment, not
okay,
after you've been used social media to get there?
Great question. Yeah. Thank you for that question. It's all about the music. The soundtrack is what we want to use as sort of the catalyst for the change that we are, okay, proposing. So I always like to envision that, like, it's 40 years in the future and CNN is doing a look back at the early aughts, the early teens, right? And they're putting together that documentary. What is the soundtrack that they use, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's so easy for us to identify the songs that were big in the 60s. They always underlay all of that footage. So my job as a protest organizer, before even naming what we are protesting about, is to set the tone. So what song is going to be playing? What are people hearing? Then I make sort of an MP3 or a track list, or I share sort of a mix of songs with people just to ignite interest. Because, again, you want this music to speak to people that are proactive, people that are looking to create change, be change agents.
Right. So you're at home and you make playlists.
Yes, but it's so much more than that.
Oh, okay. What about, you know, chants and signs
signs
and drums and things,
mm-hmm,
like that? Yeah.
Signs, that is a really, really great point. You want your signs to be vague enough so that you can use them across multiple platforms. So, for instance, one of my best signs is, this is the change we want now, right? Because what could that be for? That could be for a million things, right? So you want it to be vague enough that anybody walking by who isn't a part of this protest feels invited, feels safe, and feels included. I want people to look at my signs and go, great point. This is the change we wanted now. So that's kind of, you know, but it doesn't have to be that. It can be, now here's the change we wanted, or this is the change we were talking about, comma, now. or now let's look at change.
Right.
You know, yeah. It can be a million things. But the key is I want to be able to bust out that sign at a moment's notice. I don't necessarily have to plan or get out my supplies to be like customizing, like saying a name. That's going to take a lot of time.
Right.
Like if I have to name people on a sign.
Okay. Well, the Download's protest organizer, and I thank you for coming in, Jenna. This
thank
is great.
You.
Anything else we need to know about how to put on an effective protest?
Yeah. I would say you have to look at how you live your life. It's not just that moment when you're marching down that block of, you know, Michigan Avenue. It is how you live off protest time, too. So, for instance, I am very proud of the fact that I am a green person. I have a small carbon footprint. If I am going to ask for change, I feel like I have to be the change. So I don't eat any animals. I don't eat any fish. Some people are like, that's an animal, Jenna. And I'm like, well, it feels different because it's always separated when people are like, I'm vegetarian, but I eat fish.
Sure.
So none of that. I do none of that. I also live in the dark. I don't turn on lights at all, ever. So when the sun goes down at 3:30 in the winter, I go to bed and I have basic cable. So like I am not polluting the airwaves with any of that like Top Chef, you know, let's flip this home. And I also exclusively go to the bathroom in a Trader Joe's bag.
The Download's protest organizer, Jenna Thompson. Jenna, thanks so much for giving
us
insight.
Thank you. And I would like to invite everybody to meet me at an undisclosed area. We're going to figure out where that is, probably by a monument, probably sometime this week, to probably protest something super crazy that's happening. I want a bit part in your life. A walk on would be fine. I
just want a bit part in your life. There you go. Kate James is a performer in Chicago. Everybody seems to know Kate, and she will be actually moving to Los Angeles come February. More to come here in our new segment, Character Flaws, hashtag Character Flaws on Twitter. We will be we'll take a break. We'll get the news. After the news, we're going to hear from a Cubs fan who thinks it was a bad idea that the city did not shut down Addison and Clark. Todd Voorhees will join us to talk about his plan, the alternative plan to what the city and the Cubs were offering. Stay with us. Well, a big announcement yesterday that actually hurts the Chicago Cubs. The Cubs were asking for a security perimeter to close down Addison and Clark Street during game days. Well, it turns out that the city said no. The Cubs are obviously disappointed, but you know who else is disappointed? Chicago Cubs fans. Here to represent the fans is the senior ambassador for Chicago Cubdom, one of the biggest Cubs fans we know, Wrigleyville resident meathead Todd Voorhees. Todd, thanks for coming down.
Wrigleyville! What's up, Justin? As you said, my name is Todd Voorhees. I am 25 years old. I work at the Duraflame Corporation as senior vice president of sales. I work about 2 days a week, make about $300,000 a year. I've got a sweet pad at LaSalle and Madison, and I'm a big Dave Matthews fan. So I'm a pretty unique individual.
Yeah, very unique. So talk about this. I mean, what's your reaction to the idea that the city is not going to shut down Addison and Clark?
Con all the way. The basic proposal that we had for this street closure was take all the residents of Wrigleyville, ship them outside of that area. So we're looking at a bolted down box from the lake all the way to Western and then Irving all the way down to Fullerton. We go so far as Western because really nothing happens past Western anyway. So I take all the residents of Wrigleyville, move them out, and turn the entire area into a few things.
Wow,
place where we can sell some more bats, a big trough, and then area for the Dave Matthews cover bands.
Wow, so this would just be, this is your plan, your alternate plan is you don't think that it went far enough. You want to make it the entire north side of the city.
That's exactly right. It didn't go far enough. They needed to go five times farther.
Why? Why? What's the problem with having people live close by the park?
It's not good for the overall community of the Wrigleyville vibe. You're inviting the 24-hour party people. You have a Cubs game, and you're going to have fans like myself who are expecting that 36-hour party to go on and on and on. We're colliding every single day with your residents of Southport, with your residents of Greenview, with your residents of Bell. That's just not appropriate anymore. We're getting people telling us to be quiet. we're getting people telling us to behave, telling us to turn down songs like Best of What's Around, songs like Ants Marching, songs like Satellite.
And you refuse to do that.
They won't do it.
I mean, they may have a point. They live there and it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Maybe it's time to turn the music down.
Cubs fans' lives matter.
Right. Cubs fans' lives do matter. So, Todd, what... I mean, it's almost impossible for this plan to come into place, but I am intrigued on the different sectors. So you said one of the sectors will be just a place where they sell the little bats.
The bats. Let's take these one by one and unpack those. Mm-hmm. So you have the little bats. We're going to sell some more of them.
Okay, so you need a big area for that.
Big area. You got your different kind of inflatable bats, your wooden bats, your aluminum bats, your plastic bats for the kids. You've got your make-a-bat, which is a whole area where you can make your own bat. There's a lot of different types of bats.
Okay, and then the second area would be what you said, a Dave Matthews cover band area. Mm-hmm.
That's a Dave Matthews cover band area. It's basically a dedicated area of this very large Wrigleyville enhanced community to specific members of Dave Matthews cover bands. Bands like The Satellites, bands like The Best of What's Arounds, bands like The Ants Marchings, bands like The Jimmy Things, bands like The Crash Into Me's, Soul Asylum.
And Soul Asylum, right, of course. And then the third area, you said, is a trough.
That's right. And there's really no big design behind that other than it's just one big giant trough.
Well, it sounds like you, as a representative of Cub fans, have an idea of what you want to do with the neighborhood. Do you think that you get any support, any of the aldermen listening to you, and maybe this could come true? We could displace thousands of Chicagoans to make sure that Wrigley is truly a playground?
We've identified a number of key members of the aldermanic community. One of the new tactics we're working on is basically posting comments to Cubs fans' threads with a call to action for them to also notify those same aldermen in a really hyper-specific area, a couple of keywords. But we also, you know, through a couple of inner channels, I don't want to go into details, but do have a direct phone line to the mayor's office. So I do think that we'll see some changes in the future, which are pretty intriguing and, frankly, kind of game-changing. But I think for now, we're just going to kind of fight the good fight. You know, once again, we're going for a lot of bats, a lot of Dave Matthews cover bands, and one huge trough. We're partnering with the company AlderTrack with Mike Fouché. You might know him. He's been really helpful and instrumental in introducing us to some key members of the community. So I feel pretty confident that in a week or two, we'll be pretty good to go.
I guess I have to ask the question, you know, there's so many different bars on Clark Street. They're starting to shut down Sheffield, where it's just going to be a walking sort of pedestrian area.
Yep.
There's a lot of different places for Cub fans to really have that Disney-like feel.
Yep.
Why do you need more space?
Because the more space that we have, the more space that we need. It's kind of like that Boyle's Law, you know, the molecules of gas in a closed vessel. We just need the bigger vessel. It's pretty simple science. The other answer is that I think from an enterprise perspective, we can always grow sales. We have our regular targets, but then our stretch targets. We think if we're growing the bat sales community in the Cornelia area, why not go ahead and expand that? One of the things we're looking at doing is pushing all the residents out of Lakeview and Wicker Park farther west so that we can turn that area into one big wing tent.
So it'd be one, would it just be hot wings with buffalo or a lot of different flavors?
You're way ahead of me. I mean, we're talking buffalo, mm-hmm. barbecue, mm-hmm. raspberry, mm-hmm. teriyaki,
oh, wow.
ranch, plain.
Oh, plain. That's good.
Lightly breaded. There's a gluten-free option. Might want to even go orange. Our plan for Roscoe Village is to get everybody out of there, and we're going to bring a bunch of old players in to sign autographs.
Oh, so it'd be like an autograph area, right?
It's like an autograph station
okay.
with what's now Roscoe Village. So you've got Tuffy Rhodes, Vance Law, Rhino, Andre Dawson, mm-hmm. Mark Grace,
okay.
Kirby Puckett,
yeah,
Bud Black.
Kirby's dead, but...
Vince Coleman. Willie McGee.
So a lot of these guys aren't
Ozzie
Cubs.
Smith.
They're not... They're,
Jose Canseco.
They're just 80s... You're just
Barry Bonds.
80s players here.
Tony Gwynn.
Okay. Tony Gwynn's dead.
Yeah, we'll do holograms. Then we can also sell some of those Beavis and Butthead mirrors. And Belmont and Clark will stay the same because it's so cool.
The biggest Cubs fan, the Wrigleyville meathead, Todd Voorhees, with his plan to say the Cubs aren't going far enough. It shouldn't just be Addison and Clark. It should be the whole north side of Chicago. Todd, thanks for coming down and sharing your viewpoint.
Thank you. One quick question for you, Justin. Did you want to get back on like having this be a dedicated segment every night so that we can continue to get our voice in front of this
I think we're probably okay with just once.
So it's kind of a yes or sort of a soft yes?
Let's just say once.
Is this, I'm going to say that as a yes. Wrigleyville! I don't understand that you're embarrassed. Cannot speak for all the rest. I'm only in the lies. A lifetime's passed me by. What would you say?
Todd Voorhees never disappoints. Thanks for stopping by. Todd Voorhees, of course, played by Sandy Marshall, who works for Second City. He's actually based in Toronto now, but he's a longtime Chicagoan. So that's the plan Wednesday nights. I mean, the Wednesday night plan will be to bring you Character Flaws. Wednesday night, 10 to 11-ish. We'll end a little bit early tonight. This is our first one. But, you know, this is where so many different performers lend their talents to the show, whether it be Susan Messing and Rachel Mason or TJ Shanoff, who's done a lot of bits for us, and Mike Makings and others involved in the Chicago comedy community. We will organize them and put them together on Wednesday nights at 10 in a segment we are calling Character Flaws. I think it went pretty well, Pete. What do you think? Did you like your big Todd Voorhees guy? You love Todd Voorhees. You're a Todd Voorhees guy.
He's my favorite. That guy is the best.
What I love about it is I was just on Twitter sort of saying Todd Voorhees wants to take Wrigleyville or Roscoe Village and make it a wing tent. And people are playing along.
Like they're tweeting coming up back. With their own ideas.
Yeah, so John said on Twitter, he said, Todd Voorhees wants to shut down Lakeshore Drive and make it the Cubs' personal charter flight runway. It's perfect, right? That's exactly what it is. We should have, this should be a component of the shows. We should have the call in after about what would you do? What part of, you know, Chicago should the Cubs annex and what this should they annex it for? That's a good one, you know?
Oh, man.
I feel like, yeah, anyways, as he said, you know, to Western, because nothing after Western counts. He just said nothing except the airport, right? Anyway, Todd Voorhees, he'll be back, especially as we get into Cubs season here on Character Flaws every Wednesday night, 10 to 11. Woo! It's a download here on WGN. We're wrapping up the night. Quick programming notes. We are on. So the Blackhawks play tomorrow, and they play. Or is it Northwestern basketball? The Blackhawks are on tomorrow because they play the Lightning. They play again on Friday?
Yep.
So back to back games, and we won't be on, but we'll be on at the end. We'll, because they're early games.
10 to 11 on Thursday and
so
Friday.
So we'll be on tomorrow night at 10 o'clock. And again on Friday night at 10 o'clock.
Yep.
And I know for a fact that tomorrow night, our big guest, I'm very excited about, that, Eddie Griffin.
Ah.
Eddie Griffin, a longtime comic, stand-up comic. He was the star of Undercover Brother.
Yes.
And one of my favorite shows of all time, Malcolm and Eddie. Such a great, it was Malcolm Jamal Warner who played like the kind of straight-laced guy. He was like, I'm trying to meet girls. And Eddie was his buddy. He's like, all right. And Eddie was hilarious. It was one of my favorite. It was like kind of like one of the, it ran for 5 or 6 years, and it was one of the more successful, was it UPN? I think it was UPN instead of CW. I want to say one of those two.
Uh-huh.
But it was one of the more successful sitcoms that they had produced when one of those networks began. So there you go.
The world needs more Malcolm Jamal Warner, I say.
I know, right?
That's the best.
And he's a fun Malcolm Jamal Warner too. Adult Malcolm Jamal Warner's good time.
He did an arc on Community for a while, great, as like Shirley's husband, I think, and he wore Bill Cosby sweaters, which I thought was really funny.
He's the black Jason Bateman.
Ah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's kind of like that guy that you remember from the shows, but then he's on and you're like, this guy's solid. This guy can do anything.
Yeah.
Bateman just turned that into a career in movies where he just plays the same character over and over. The same guy that he plays as on Arrested Development, like in all the movies. If you watch, you ever see Horrible Bosses?
No.
Yeah, you know.
How'd you know?
Yeah, is he in that?
Yeah.
Jason Bateman, is he like the...
He's the dad. Yeah, I think he's the dad.
Oh, right. Yeah. And he plays the same. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see him put a mustache on and, like, go real gruff. You know,
yeah.
And, like, do something where it's, like, a total out of left field. Like a Eddie Redmayne style.
Yeah.
Eddie Redmayne, who's somehow the new British actor that everybody needs to pay attention to, played Stephen Hawking last year.
Yep.
And in this year's movie, the Danish girl. He's in drag.
Yep.
There you go.
You know, you want him to do something.
I'd like to see Eddie Redmayne and Jason Bateman do a Freaky Friday, where they're like they play each other, but then there's something weird happens, like
yes,
big, and then Redmayne has to be Jason Bateman. And Bateman has to be Redmayne.
Yeah.
But they're in each other's bodies.
Oh, man. Come on, Redmayne.
That's pretty good. I forgot who we were talking to, but they had the good idea that we should have people who are in SAG-AFTRA union, in the union,
mm-hmm.
Are getting the screeners. Because the SAG-AFTRA Awards, the SAG Awards are coming up here, I think, on Sunday or maybe next week, the week after. But we should do a call-in like, or go over to the office and poll them, because that's like the perk of being in SAG-AFTRA. You get the screeners. You get to vote.
I know. And I see, and it irritates me because, you know, I'm, you know, schlepping out to the movies because right. I want to see all these things. And then I see, like, people posting on Facebook, you know, like with their 10 movies, all, you know, all the best pictures. I'm like, come on, man. Really bothers me.
So, that would be good.
Yeah.
Right? Because then we get them on to tell us who they voted for. Because that's pure. Like, the problems that we were talking about earlier on the carryout with the Oscars. Like, you just, who's the actual, who's old Hollywood? Who am I going to vote for? What's Leonardo DiCaprio in? Right? That's what you feel like is voting for the Oscars. Oh, God, which one wears an ascot? That's who I'm voting for.
Yeah.
Do you think Sylvester Stallone's going to win? Is he up? Yeah, he's up.
Yeah.
Is he going to win?
He might.
Oh, God. That's so dumb.
Why?
I'm not a big Sylvester Stallone fan.
Well, I mean, it's Rocky, though.
Yeah, I know. But you know what? I didn't see the movie, so I shouldn't talk about it. I just know that he's probably up against somebody that was in Brian D'Arcy James' movie, Spotlight.
Yeah, Spotlight was so good. That should win Best Picture. You know, The Revenant, you know, Bear Attacks, that irritates
you
me.
You don't like Bear. Well, you like
I haven't
Bear
seen
Attacks.
It, so I shouldn't say that.
But I recognize this, and this may be just a flaw in how we approach this show, but I was watching the Critics' Choice Awards, and they had Best Comedy or Best Drama, and they did all the, and I didn't see any of it. Any of it. Like, there was, like, even TV shows. I'm like, I ain't never seen the Mr. Robot. Like, and I'm like, I'm supposed to be this sort of like, you know, I'm supposed to be the guiding light.
Yeah.
You know, you listen
to me. We come
to
you for.
They're like, Kaufman will tell us what to think of Mozart in the Jungle.
Yeah.
But I've never seen it. So I got to get on my, I got to get on it.
Yeah. Because, yeah, people will look to you. People want to come to the download for your expertise on everything.
I just feel like if they wanted to come here for River Monsters trivia. I got all those, man. That's the best show on TV. It's the best show on TV because I forget the guy's name.
What is it? What is River Monsters?
River Monsters is one guy. He's like I think he's an English guy, English fisherman, who's like hardcore, rough and tumble. You could see it in his skin. Bro's been around. He's fished the world. And he's very philosophical. And what it is he hunts down the stories and investigates killer fish. So, like, I heard in Burmese there was a fish that killed two swimmers. And he goes, that's a terrible River Monster impression, but he goes there and then he talks to them and then he proves to us once and for all that he's the best fisherman in the world. And he always catches the fish. He eliminates all the stuff. He's like, well, it couldn't be this, but I do know this kind of water. And that could be an Arapaima. I guess he's Australian. And then he goes, the Arapaima is a fish I don't want to deal with. And then they show the graphic, 7 feet long with iron, like, you know, gills. I wrestled one of these back in 1976. And this scar to show it proven. You're like, oh, awesome. And then he goes and catches it. It's a perfect, perfect show.
What network is this on?
I don't know.
You know?
At Animal Planet.
Ah.
But it's like, and like he'll go after, like the Loch Ness Monster. I saw one on Loch Ness Monster.
Wait,
and yeah, he goes after it, and he comes up with a theory that he goes through all this like investigation. I don't want to give it away, but he like finds the fish that people may think is Loch Ness Monster. It's like this big shark. It's like a huge, like weird 400 feet. I don't have eyes, kind of shark.
Oh.
Yeah, that, like, is only in the Nordic. And you're just like, that scares. And he's like, I got to get down there and take a look. He just jumps in the water. And you're like, what are you doing, man? What are you doing?
I watched that over Mr.
Yeah.
Robot.
See? Where's that? And the winner and the nominee.
Yeah. You okay over there? You're shocking yourself.
I just electrocuted the studio. I hit one of Rose. Rose got a bunch of buttons here, and I just hit it when I grabbed it. But the winner is Alan Johnson for River Monsters. And he gets up there, and it'd be great. So, all right, Patty Vasquez is up next. Well, that's going to do it for us tonight. Patty Vasquez, pretty late with Patty Vasquez, is up next. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.